All right, everybody, welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. I believe this is episode 203. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. Once again, I'm back. Go España. With me, as always, Greg Lay.
Ahoy, hoy, everyone.
Checking in from the U of the K. And Jonathan Lindemann.
What up?
And also, James Jones.
This is going to be a much more depressing blank and three episode than the last one.
Yes.
Really? That depends on your point of view, doesn't it?
Hey, don't call it yet. We just started.
Oh, no. I'm pretty sure we're set for life on this one.
I guess what we should say about that is that for our newer listeners, if you haven't picked up on the hints that we drop every now and then, episode 103, 100 episodes ago, about 2 years ago, is a clusterfuck of historical proportions. And I kind of recommend that you go listen to it. It's a qualified recommendation.
Not while you're eating, though. I would.
Yeah, if only to just understand the references that we make.
But I think you have to go 103 and then the start of 104 for the response, and then you're good to go.
For the corrections.
I didn't say that.
For the return of the professor.
I said the response. There is a difference.
All right. Well, this is a new day and a new episode, and we're going to start with new business from Mr. John Lindemann.
All right. Yeah, I don't have a whole lot here. I've actually been out of town for the last couple of days, so I haven't played a whole lot. But I actually did, over the weekend, I returned to New Super Mario Bros. Wii, which I haven't played in a while. I was kind of, you know, getting a jonesing for some old school platforming action.
Did you play it alone or with a group?
Alone. Yeah, I just played it. The thing is, I'm stuck in... Actually, I think I've made it to World 3 now. Whoop-de-doo. But yeah, it was kind of like a change of pace from Dragon Quest IX, so... Like a big change of pace.
It certainly would be.
They're almost identical. If you're blind.
But it's just like that's one of those games that I'll always kind of go back to. It's like I don't feel any pressure to kind of like play it all the way through. But, you know, just because you can kind of sit there and just hop from world to world to world and kind of play it at your own pace. I'm sure 3 or 4 years from now, I'll complete the whole game. But
you'll always have the NPDs to remind you it exists because it's probably going to keep selling for a long time.
Well, John, I think you actually hit on something interesting there about this particular Mario game, which is that I feel like New Super Mario on Wii, more than any other Mario game, has almost no momentum. Mm-hmm. Like from level to level, I could totally quit playing after every level. Yeah. And it's not that I'm not having fun. You know, it might even come down to something really detailed like the sound effects or the music when you finish a level or some kind of graphical presentation. But there's something about it that I don't really feel compelled to play just one more level.
Yeah.
And even like last year when we did the retroactive on Super Mario World, and I've played that game a bunch of times, but even then, I felt like I always wanted to play one more level. And in New Super Mario Bros. Wii, I never felt that. And so it was kind of like reading like a biography or something where there's not really any plot. But I felt like even though I was enjoying it, I almost had to push myself to keep playing more of it.
Yeah, I feel like it's kind of sandboxy, and there's at least, I mean, you mentioned Super Mario World. In Super Mario World, you always feel like you're kind of... like, everything you do does something that moves you towards your goal. And while that happens in New Super Mario Bros. Wii, it doesn't feel as pressing, because I just kind of get the idea that you can sidestep any obstacle that you might come across. Just seems to be a very clear, easy path through the entire game. And then everything else around it is just optional.
That could be caused by the multiplayer focus. Mm-hmm. Because you can tell that in a lot of cases, they made an easy path and a hard path.
Yeah.
And it's probably for when you have like a mixed company, you know, of people playing through, and some people might want to take one path and some people are more skilled than others. But when you're playing alone, it presents you with this weird dilemma of, well, I could take the hard path, but it doesn't appear that there's really any reason to do so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he probably just collected star coins in certain cases, tend to be, you know, put on more difficult routes or hard to find places or hard to reach places just in themselves.
Yeah.
I think some of the reason may be, in terms of the lack of propulsion forward, could be just because there isn't much of a visual or audiovisual even journey through the game that you haven't seen before, because
that is a huge part of it, Greg.
Based on the one for DS, they basically rehash the same world themes except in a different order.
And even then, a lot of it's, you know, a lot of the graphical elements, a lot of the characters that you see, a lot of the level elements are things from a bunch of previous Super Mario games. So yeah, I don't feel like I need to get to the next level to see what new thing. Whereas like I've been playing a lot of Galaxy 2 this week. I finally got the 70, and you know I beat Bowser again. that's another story, but and at least in that game, I feel like the world map in Galaxy 2 is not really great at pushing you forward either. Actually, I think the world map is kind of shitty in both Mario games on the Wii, Galaxy 2 and New. But at least in Galaxy 2, I'm excited to check out the next level because I know there'll be something in there that I've probably never seen or done before. Mm-hmm. And in New Super Mario Bros. Wii, you know that there almost certainly will not be something in there that you've never seen or done before.
Yeah, very. And one thing I was thinking about as I was playing is I was stuck on level 2-4, which is one where the wind is blowing you from left to right, you know, periodically. Mm. And it was just a bitch. And I brought up the super guide on it. I couldn't believe it. I was just sucking so bad.
At 2-4?
Did you use it?
No, I didn't use it. Are you kidding? I have my pride.
What do you think,
man?
I'm a bitch? Come on.
I have my pride, but I was like, wow, I guess I suck this bad. But then, so finally, I beat it, and I get to the next, and I just breeze through the next couple of worlds. Just breeze through them. And so it just varies wildly from world to world.
The windy levels are particularly nasty.
That's something that they think first conceived in the Super Mario Bros. 2 in Japan. So that tells you.
The wind was invisible in Super Mario Bros. 2.
There was some leaves that tip you off.
Oh,
I played it on Virtual Console not long ago.
Oh.
There was a tip off.
Some visual cue that you're about to have your day ruined.
Yeah.
Well, I haven't played the so-called lost levels since the Game Boy Color edition of
DX.
Mario. So yeah, DX.
I just felt that my skills have declined definitely in action platforming. I was thinking about it in comparison to like first person shooters, where if you don't play first person shooters for a long time, you come in and get. You just completely suck, and I think platformers are definitely the same. I mean, you really, there are certain kind of reflexes that you develop and just kind of, I don't know, you almost wire yourself. The more you play platformers, you kind of wire yourself to do better at them, and it's pretty obvious that I'm just completely unwired at this point.
Yeah, I think that's why you got such a wide range of people's testimonials in terms of, or impressions in terms of New Super Mario Bros. Wii, because I heard a lot of people say, oh my god, I can't believe how hard this is. And I thought that it was a pretty easy game, except for like one or two levels that were just frustrating, you know, like just nasty level design. But I play so many 2D platformer type games, you know, including stuff like Mega Man, that New Super Mario Bros. Wii is not particularly, it's kind of in the middle of the range of the stuff that I play. And so it was challenging sometimes, but I didn't really have any particular trouble with it.
Well, what I find is I just lack patience. I just completely lack patience. So I just make stupid moves.
We know, John.
Well, Galaxy 2, I think on the whole, Galaxy 2 is a more difficult game.
There's no question it is. I think on the whole, Galaxy 2's 2D platforming is better than the 2D platforming in New Super Mario Brothers. The sense of being propelled forward is definitely better in those two. Hmm. They're certainly more creative than their counterparts.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So, I don't know, maybe they should let EAD Tokyo make the next New Super Mario Brothers.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
yes.
Sure, they can make anything they want as far as I'm concerned.
Fuck yes. Please.
Jonathan, they can come to my house and hit me with a baseball bat. I don't care.
Absolutely. I'd be like, you see this? Is this head wound? It's from Tokyo. EAD Tokyo, baby.
They gave it to me to the rhythm of the music in the background.
Let's see. One last piece of new business I picked up. I picked up EGM number 239, in which former site director Billy Berghammer references Planet GameCube and name drops Johnny Metz in the editorial.
Yeah.
Very, very nice. So, maybe feel good. Maybe feel like I'm one of the cool kids, sort of, or like the guy behind the guy sort of thing.
So what does he say about Mr. Metz, though?
He just gives a list of people he wants to thank for helping him get – because that was Billy's first print issue where he was in charge.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
Because the first issue that they put out was without an editor-in-chief. So Billy was brought on after that issue was done. And he does this editorial in the beginning where he literally name drops me. Like, literally in a list of, like, 25 people.
It's his Oscars acceptance speech, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah, he's like, I've had the opportunity to work with many talented people, including Jonathan Metz, bold, capital, and then everybody else is, like, in, like, you know, small italics.
I also had the displeasure of working with a guy Canadian. I think he lives in Atlanta now. Stay away from that.
I was unsurprisingly left off the list.
I think the only other person he mentioned from our site was Justin Nation, who Justin founded 64 Source, and I think he was also doing Operation in 2000. That's what it was.
Some of these websites had shitty names. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but he basically Operation in 2000 ran for like 6 months or so, and then he merged all their content with Planet in 2000 and merged the staff as well. So Justin was a big player back in that era of our website, and also he programmed the first version of Planet GameCube.
Was that the purple one, or was that the
purple one and the
Oh God, the green one.
The green one, oh. And then the purple one that followed.
Oh.
Yeah. So Justin was he stopped writing once he started coding the site. He didn't write very much anymore, but he was involved for several years there, and a very good guy. I've never met him in person, which is too bad. But yeah, I subscribed to EGM once, especially, actually I subscribed like the day that I found out Billy was going to be editor-in-chief, and I got that issue and my name was in it. I was like, oh my God, this is insane.
It's a complete video gamer. I don't know, if you're really old school, that's like pretty much the coolest thing.
Well, so actually I'll take this opportunity to kind of mention, I think it's pretty safe for me to mention this because I think the print deadline has passed, so everything's pretty much set in stone, but I'm supposed to have an article in the next print edition of EGM, which should come out sometime in August. I sent a freelance pitch to Billy, and he liked it, so he told me, go ahead and write it. I'm not getting a job there. I'm not leaving NWR or the podcast or anything like that. It's just a side thing. But I was like, you know, if I can get something into EGM, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
Because I totally grew up reading EGM as a kid.
Like, I'm geeked for you.
It's really, yeah, I know. I'm pretty excited. It's basically, I really did it mainly just for the prestige and just for the weirdness of like actually having the opportunity to do that because I know the editor. And I have to say, I mean, I worked really hard on the article. I think it's pretty cool. It's about the ESRB and the whole Supreme Court case. So it's kind of newsy. It's not a whole lot of editorial. But I think it's a pretty cool article. It kind of looks at it from a perspective that I haven't seen elsewhere. And I really, really hope it makes in the final cut. I'm pretty sure that it will. But it's going to be totally bizarre looking at that in print.
Yeah, that's going to be awesome. I'm definitely going to pick up that issue.
I'm excited about it. So anyway, John, how far did you get in Dragon Quest IX?
I think I made it to Stornway.
Okay, that's like the second big city.
Yep.
I'm a little bit past that, but not a whole lot. And I was in Spain last week, so I wasn't even able to pick it up until this past weekend. And I haven't played a ton of it since then, because I've also been playing a lot of FF13. It's really hard for me to play two RPGs at the same time, plus Mother 3 on top of that. Mm-hmm. Really, three RPGs. That's... It's a lot to process. It's a lot of systems to keep up with.
I think that's probably more RPGs than I played to the age of 22.
That's more than I played this month.
Yeah. Yeah. For James, three RPGs at once is nothing unusual. But for me, it's pretty uncommon. But I'm less than 10 hours into Dragon Quest IX, I think. So I'm not going to say much about it. But I like it. It's not much different from other Dragon Quests, which doesn't surprise me. And the one thing that people have kind of, you know, that I heard some complaints about before it came out is that because you create your character and then you sort of customize your team of characters, that your party doesn't have much personality. And so all the storytelling and all the character development in the game comes from outside. And I just want to throw it out there that that's not really anything new for Dragon Quest. I mean, most of the Dragon Quest series is like that.
Yeah.
Well, it's because people haven't played Dragon Quest games.
Yeah, I guess so. Maybe people are coming in fresh to the series, but it's actually, I can only think of a couple of Dragon Quest games I've played where your character actually does have any personality, or even anyone in your party.
Zelda.
Yeah, it's very, right, as a Nintendo gamer, it's not going to be anything shocking, because it's totally Mario, it's totally Zelda, it's your character doesn't talk.
Yeah, it's like, well, like, I mean, Link is Link now, but in the first game, he was just like, name him.
Well, you can still name him.
Yeah, I suppose you can. Man, I just leave him as Link now, so I haven't done that.
I usually do Johnny. It does, not that it matters.
He's named Link to me, so it just kind of bugs me. Jonathan. It's like, yeah. It's not, you know, it's Link. Link is like an established character now. It's not just like...
Yeah, my copy of Ocarina of Time, my original one, was a used copy because I got on the N64 kind of late. And somebody had named theirs. I can't remember what the name was. I'm like, fuck you, that's not his name. Delete it.
Actually, so in terms of the fact that you can recruit your party and you can change your jobs, it actually is very, very similar to Dragon Quest III. So if anybody's ever played that and you're looking for some kind of point of reference for Dragon Quest IX, the way the character development works, very similar to that. The other part of it is that you get these skill points when you get leveled up. You don't always get them, but when you level up, like maybe half the time you get skill points, and you can apply them to 5 or 6 different categories. So you can upgrade your sword skills or your whip skills or your spear skills or your shield, or something like that, or maybe your magic skills. And so you can sort of customize your character's development and create specializations or build them up as a generalist so you're good at all these different things. But I really like that element. That's pulled straight out of Dragon Quest VIII, and I really, really like that system in VIII, and I'd totally forgotten about it because it's been a few years since I played it. So Dragon Quest IX, the main thing I would say about it, it's really pretty.
It is really pretty.
I mean, it's one of the best looking DS games I've ever seen.
I think the whole thing looks pretty too, not just like the character models or
the world actually looks better than the characters, I think.
Yep. The whole art style is great all the way across.
Yeah, they really chose a style of art as a graphical style that works really, really, really well on the DS. And they have the technical chops to back it up.
Mm-hmm.
So I certainly think it looks better than either of the Zelda games on DS. You know, which have a similar style. Similar, not exactly the same, but similar. It's very cartoony and very 3D.
Yeah, I think it's so impressive that, you know, they make everything look really good, even though they're constantly zooming in on what should be absolutely horrible looking textures.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of times you go into a conversation with a non-playable character and the camera will zoom in for like a cutscene and you think, ooh, this is going to end poorly, you know, like in Final Fantasy IV. But no, it still looks good even when you zoom in. You're right. So, yeah, I'll be playing Dragon Quest for a long time. In terms of gameplay and story, I haven't seen enough of it to say much. But I will say very quickly, as I mentioned earlier, I have been playing quite a bit of Final Fantasy XIII because I went like 2 months without playing it just because I literally forgot to take it to Texas with me. And then when I got back, I've been traveling a lot and I didn't want to pick it up for 30 minutes here or there. So I finally got back into it, and I played up to the point where you get into Chapter 11, which is where you get to Grand Pulse, and you have this huge world before you. It's totally different from everything before it, just in terms of now you can actually explore, and sometimes you get lost. You're not really sure where you are, where you're supposed to be going. It's a really, really large area, and everything before that in the game is just a corridor. Just go forth, young man. I mean, that's all there is to it, the entire, you know, 25 hours up to that point. And then all of a sudden, bam, huge world map. And that's exciting. I mean, that's one of my favorite parts about any RPG is like being on a big world and exploring it. And I love that about Dragon Quest VIII, for instance. And I love it about many of the previous Final Fantasies. So I'm really glad to see that. And it is definitely disorienting because it's so much more expansive. And the map system can't really keep up with it. You can tell that the map system wasn't really designed for this. But I am enjoying it. And I don't know how long it's going to take me to get through this part of the game. But it is kind of a nice change of pace. So I'm glad that I picked the game back up and push forward like the extra 2 hours that I had to do to finally get to that point, because it's the part of the game that everybody talks about.
Now, would you say that game is worth $20?
Hell yeah! Have you seen it for $20?
Well, Best Buy, I think that might be this week only, but Best Buy, they had it on for $40, and then I think if you're like a Best Buy, like, Gamer Zone reward member, there's like a $20 coupon for it, so you can get it for $20.
Yeah, John, you would probably like it. I mean, you'll never have time to play it, but...
Exactly, that's why I haven't gone out and snatched it up, but...
James... I'm really shocked that James hasn't picked it up, because I think James would really like it, especially if he likes shitty Square RPGs like Last Remnant. He should play like the real thing.
You've never played The Last Remnant, Johnny.
Yeah, but I know it's shitty.
Oh, God. What hubris.
I just know.
I don't have to play it to know it's shitty, James. Uh-huh. That's what Johnny is saying to you.
It's not hubris, it's wisdom. Okay.
Despite all the reviews to the contrary, it's a shitty game. Johnny,
yeah,
Nash.
No. No, James, I really think you should check out Final Fantasy XIII. It's a great game.
It's not that I haven't had a desire to play the game. It's just that it hasn't been on the list of games that when I go to the store I get, basically.
Yeah, James has kind of gone underground really with RPGs. I mean, he's kind of going like he's the more obscure the better.
Well, we'll hear about that in a sec, but
just as a general trend.
And actually I think you should check it out sometime. I know you're kind of a RPG neophyte.
Yeah, it's a bit console up. I just, it's difficult to get me to sit in front of the TV and play console games for that extensive kind of period. I tend to play more short bursts on consoles.
Right. It could be a problem, because if FF13 is definitely a lengthy game, but I do think you would probably enjoy it. It's much more directed than your typical RPG, at least up through the first 25 hours.
A couple of times it's already been cheap here, like... Yeah, 16, 17 quid, and I've thought about it.
Definitely worth picking up. So the other game I've been playing, and I'll be brief about this because the game is brief, is called Limbo. Came out on Xbox Live Arcade. It's the first game in the Summer of Arcade this year, which I think the Summer of Arcade overall looks not very good this year. But anyway, Limbo is a very interesting, very artsy game. If you like artsy games, you will like this a lot. If you like Braid and Flower and stuff like that, I mean, it plays quite differently from those, but in terms of aesthetic, in terms of like a very minimalist presentation, very evocative graphics and sound, it's very much in line with those. And it plays as a sort of puzzle platformer. In fact, I told these guys before we started recording in an email, Limbo plays like a boy in his blob without the blob. But the boy moves a little fat. He's a little more agile than the boy in the Wii game. And he can do more. I mean, he can push and pull things, and he can run and jump. That's all he can do, basically. But the game is designed around that, so it doesn't feel constricted, you know. But actually, I think the pacing is much better in Limbo than A Boy in His Blob, because you're never, like, waiting around for the blob. You're never sitting around waiting for him to come back to you or whatever. But anyway, Limbo is, it's this game. It looks like a silhouette, the art style. Yeah. It's all black and white and shades of gray. It's totally 2D. There's no color whatsoever in the game. There's really no music. There's sound effects. There's a little bit of ambient sound, but there's really no music at all. It's a very spare experience. And because of that, I think very effectively, it comes across as really creepy. And I think that's definitely intentional. And it works for the game, because the game is sort of like subversively violent and macabre. Macabre is probably the better word. I mean, because you can just die in such a variety of ways. And you will die quite a bit. But there's very little platforming skill involved. Like when John said, he's kind of getting back into his mechanical skills, his reflex skills of playing Mario. You don't really need any of that in Limbo. It's more about timing. It's about learning when to jump at the right time, but it's not like you have to have a lot of skill to play it. It's more about thinking. It's more about paying attention, thinking about what's going on, and just reacting to it. And if you mess up, you go back like 5 seconds and you try it again.
It does sound really similar to A Boy in His Blob then, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is very much. I mean, I think I haven't really seen that comparison out there, but I think that's the most obvious comparison you can draw is A Boy in His Blob. And it's really good. It's a little frustrating sometimes, but the puzzles, I've been very impressed with the thought that goes into the puzzles and the solutions that you have to come across, because they're, you don't have to come up with any weird tricks, really. Everything's right there in the game. You just have to think about what can my character do? What's going on in this environment? How do I put those two together to solve this puzzle? It's great. And I think the only problem with Limbo really is that it's really short. It's like 2 hours long, like maybe 2.5, 3 hours, depending on your style. But 3 hours max, yo. I'm almost done with it, and I bought it last night. I've played it twice, and I'm pretty much done with it.
And in this sort of game where it's heavily leveraged on devising solutions to puzzles, limited scope for replayability?
Yeah, you could say that. And it's $15.
Oh, it's snap,
I mean, as
yeah.
download titles go, it's kind of a premium download title.
Yeah, that's bullshit.
They say everything in the Summer of Arcade is $15 this year. Yeah. Everything's $15 and everything's like at least a timed exclusive to Xbox.
Yeah, that's part of how they choose the Summer of Arcade, is that they're all exclusive. Yeah, and Limbo, I hope it comes to PS3 eventually, certainly so more people can play it. I think it's a wonderful game. It's very, very creative. It really has a unique atmosphere to it, has a unique feel to it that I think is totally worth experiencing. I like the game a lot, but I do think it's either overpriced or too short. I don't want to say too short, because artistically, maybe it's exactly the right length. You know, maybe it would be tedious if it was longer than that. But I think compared to what else I can get for $10-$15, a two-hour game it's really hard to justify $15 for 2 hours. I mean, I'm just saying, like, I can go see a summer blockbuster for $15, and depending on what it is, actually, like Inception, I paid much less than that. I paid like $8 to see Inception, and it's 2.5 hours long. It's the same length as Limbo, and it's more entertaining. I'm sorry. I mean, it's just, you know, it's more gripping. I'm going to remember it more. There's more to discuss. There's more to chew on. There's just more to it. And with Limbo, I feel like, you know, considering that it's black and white and really simple 2D graphics and there's no music, you know, did it really take 3 years to build this two-hour game? Like, there's no fucking assets.
Yeah.
Like, there's very little art in this game.
He wrote a line of code a day.
Like, I understand they, you know, they're, I'll also say there's no repetition. Like, they don't really reuse ideas, so I respect that a great deal. It doesn't feel like they're churning out level designs or they're churning out puzzles, you know? It does feel like it's very original. Everything you do is like you do it once and then you move on and now you have to do something new. So I appreciate that very much. I know that takes time to put together, but 2 hours is a pretty damn short video game for $15. That's all I'm saying.
How big is the team that made it?
I watched the credits and it's a lot more people than made Braid.
Wow.
It's like 15 people. It's like more than 10 people. Anyway, that's Limbo. I do recommend it, but if you're on the fence, wait for a price drop.
Yeah.
So James is up next.
Yes.
With a thrilling conclusion to the ZX
saga. I broke the declaratory statement I would make that I would never finish Mega Man ZX and finished Mega Man ZX because...
I'm stunned.
James, you finish everything.
I was only one level boss away as of last Thursday, so it was really just that and the final boss. Mm-hmm. And I still strongly dislike this game because it literally says, okay, fuck it, we're going to make everything unnecessarily time-consuming.
That's your complaint, and yet your next game is an RPG.
Yeah, but that's different. No, it is different.
Unnecessarily time-consuming? That's what RPGs are about, right?
No, because it's unnecessarily time-consuming for no reason other than to punish you, effectively. It is a punishment mechanism for making you lose. So if you lose, you have to completely retraverse the world. There's no reason for that, because in RPGs, you can at least save in places that are close to where you were.
So there's no checkpoints in ZX?
Well, there are, but you have 2 lives. So you're effed.
So once your lives run out, you don't restart at a checkpoint?
No, you go back to wherever you started the mission, which could be fuck all across the world.
Okay, yeah, that's messed up.
And apparently this proves the inherent flaws in Metroid's game design when no such issues...
Yeah, because every Metroid game is just like that.
No, Metroid 2 is a lot like that.
No, it's not. If you die in Metroid 2, you do not go back to the beginning of
the
game.
No, but there is the whole concept of where the hell am I supposed to go? Because at least in this game, you have a map, even if it's a completely worthless map.
So it highlights different flaws?
Well, no, it highlights a similar flaw that Metroid 2 took to another level of, you don't even get a map.
This is tenuous even for you, James.
No,
this
I'm is. Sorry.
This fallacious argument.
If the Metroid mechanics, light Metroid mechanics, ruined a franchise that I will play religiously, then there's something very wrong.
I see no evidence that Metroid has ruined this game. It sounds like the developers ruined this game.
No.
James, it's okay if you don't like Metroid, but you can't say that Metroid has ruined other games.
It has ruined this game.
No.
In fact, it ruined the Castlevania series too.
No.
Yes, definitely.
No, Igarashi ruined the Castlevania series by making the same game 8 times.
Yeah, it was good until they started to reuse every single asset.
No, that's his new 360 game.
Yeah, that's Harmony of Despair.
Harmony of Assets.
That really is a fantastic name for it.
Harmony of Assets. Oh my god. Oh my god. That is
exactly what the game is.
That's piercing. That is piercingly accurate.
Oh, I hit you right to the core, Igarashi. Right to the core. Oh, cut right to the heart of you.
It's true, though.
Oh,
he's like,
man.
Should we up-raise
these? Bone on that one, John.
Should
Lincoln.
We up-raise these assets? No. It'll just be really fucking zoomed out.
So, James, I heartily congratulate you on finishing Mega Man ZX, and I ask you to move on.
Yes. So, the first of my triple purchase day was Tales of Vesperia, which is the only game when I bought the three during that deal GameStop was running, is the only one I went in knowing I actually wanted, because I actually like Tales games. Shocking.
Do you want to tease with the other two?
The other two are frighteningly similar if you look at the box art. It's No More Heroes 2 and Red Steel 2.
I think you'll like No More Heroes 2. I haven't played Red Steel 2 yet. I'm looking forward to trying it. But
I played it back at E3, and I kind of understand what I'm getting into, so I know what I'm dealing with. And reading the reviews, it's basically what I saw a year ago.
Yeah.
It was the third game of the buy two, get one free, and I ran out of time to find the third game. I'm like, fuck it, we're going Red Steel 2.
So I guess since all the new Tales games for Nintendo platforms are apparently not coming
never
to
gonna
America,
come out in the US.
Then I'm kind of interested to hear what you think about Vesperia, which you got on 360, right?
Yeah. So there is a PS3 version, but it hasn't come to the US. It's kind of like the collection version, which adds more content to the 360 version. It came out like 6 months later in Japan. Hmm. But probably the last Tales game to come to the US since the Tales studio is in bankruptcy. Yes. Hmm. Which, by the way, I didn't know a wholly owned studio of a publisher could be in bankruptcy while the publisher's in fine condition.
Well, I mean, Sonic Team has been creatively bankrupt for a decade.
Well, that's different. I mean, you could argue the Tales staff has been creatively bankrupt since Tales of Symphonia. You don't have it. I mean, it's fine. But if you've played Tales of Symphonia, which if you're listening to this podcast, there's a statistically high chance you did, because that game sold really well on the GameCube. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of that. I mean, it's really the same game. And that's kind of what I like about the Tales games, because there's no pretension whatsoever. The story is going to be super light. I mean, there's going to be crazy bullshit that makes no sense.
Well, it's like Dragon Quest, then.
Yeah,
like,
it is.
Like, you always know what you're getting into.
Yeah, you're getting into what is essentially going to be a crazy bullshit story that has no connection to the previous games, with a couple exceptions. And you're going to get a battle system that is its primary draw, which is a brawler system, which I actually really enjoy. Because it's a game where the battles, unlike most RPGs, can last all of 3.5 seconds.
Oh, yeah. I do like that. I like the fast pace of
yeah,
the Tales
games.
Yeah,
I mean, you get rewarded for having 2-second battles. It's fantastic.
That, hey, by the way, Final Fantasy 13, same thing.
Yeah.
You get rewarded for beating the enemy really fast.
I think right now I'm about 13 hours in, which means I've basically just started based on my previous experience with Tales games. The thing about these games, though, is that, like I said, they've got crazy bullshit stories. This game hasn't quite taken its turn into the bullshit territory yet, but I know it's coming because it is a Tales game. Its combat system is essentially exactly the same as Symphonia. And basically, they didn't do a whole lot with the graphics in order because of the HD, the 360 move. But it's still really, really pretty because of the art style. It up-reses extremely well. So what you get is, you get these cel-shaded graphics with color in HD. It's amazing. Like, to get pastels in HD on cel-shaded graphics, you would think, literally, it might be nothing you've ever seen before in your 360 collection. Because it might be a list of only 5 games that actually check off those checkboxes.
Yeah.
I mean, it is just really attractive to look at. I mean, it's hard to describe a Tales game because they're basically all the fucking same. But, I mean, it's a game where you're going to have to grind some, but it's not a big deal because it may take...
You don't have to grind. You could spend your Microsoft points.
That's true, if you're a whore. But you could basically grind in like 30 seconds and go up 2 levels. It's so easy. The characters are all, you know, archetypes of bullshit anime stories, but you don't care because the story's really not all that important because you won't understand it anyway. And they don't care. They don't care, you don't understand. It's fine. I mean, like I said, it really is a franchise that has almost no pretension in its RPG-ness. It is the anti-Final Fantasy. It is. I mean, it doesn't care that you don't understand the story. It doesn't care that the characters are kind of all the same but from game to game, even though they're different characters. It doesn't really care that it's the same combat system as before. It just doesn't give a shit. And I kind of like that about it. The issue with this game I have is that it's actually fixed versus Tales of Symphonia and Dawn of the New World, which I spoke about earlier in the year, in that they actually kind of did a good job pointing you in the right direction, whereas most Tales games are like, fuck it, you'll figure it out. They're like, let's go to this cave. And like, where's that cave? It's to the west. And you leave the city that you're in and you go west and there's an ocean. And you're like, well, shit, where am I supposed to go? And they really meant, oh, well, if you go south, you can actually walk around this peninsula and then get on the other side of the ocean. But this game, they actually point you in the right direction, which I kind of miss the fact that you could just kind of get lost in a Tales game, wind up in a dungeon, three dungeons before you're supposed to be there, get your ass handed to you, and then spend the rest of the game just going downhill because you power leveled through some bullshit dungeon for 75 hours because you got lost. Like,
actually, I think only you do that, James.
No, everybody does that in a Tales game because they wind up in the wrong fucking dungeons. Like Tales of Symphonia, you could famously get on a boat before you were supposed to. Because the game just let you do it. And it's like, fuck it, you can do that if you want. And you ended up like 15 levels too low for the dungeon you wound up at. And you couldn't go back on the boat because the boat wouldn't leave to go back until you beat that dungeon.
I never heard about this. That didn't happen to me.
It happened to me both times I played it. And the second time I knew it was going to happen and I forgot.
That's pretty old school. It's where like it's where bad design meets kind of like, oh, that's kind of charming that I can do that and screw myself up.
Yeah, it is. And it's kind of sad. Like, the Tales Studios finally learned, hey, people really don't like being dropped in a dungeon they're 15 levels too low to beat. Let's try to fix that. I love these games because they're simple. The dungeons are heavily leveraged on puzzles. So kind of the kind of puzzles you would see in Lufia 2, Golden Sun, those kinds of puzzles within a level.
Not as good as Lufia 2.
No, but there aren't any RPGs out there that have puzzles as good as Lufia 2's.
Brain Lord.
Well,
it's Brain Lord, biatch.
Lufia 2 is on its own level, and I'm pretty sure Natsume is going to bring it back down to the rest of the pack with their remake, but...
Yeah, I think so too.
That would be my most depressing moment of E3.
Natsume didn't make the remake, though.
No, they didn't.
They're just publishing it.
They paid for it.
Yeah.
They could have killed it and did not.
Well, look, I've said before on the show, at least I believe I have, that that's like my favorite RPG of the SNES era. So,
Yeah, that's a good choice. Lufia is a great series. I mean, I think the first one's great, too.
Yeah, it's...
First one's very Dragon Quest-y or Final Fantasy-like. The second one's a little more...
It's more its own thing.
The second one has more personality.
Yeah, I mean, that and the Breath of Fire series, which doesn't get much mention either.
I like Breath of Fire a lot. I played the first three, maybe the first four.
Yeah, that was the weird tangent of SNES RPG series don't get any love.
Thanks for Tales of Vesperia.
Yeah.
So, there's nothing left to say, right?
Only that I probably have 100 hours left.
Oh, God. Okay, Greg! Yes. Let's talk about some games that are not 100 hours long.
They certainly aren't, yes. To be candid, I haven't had a lot of time to play much of anything this week, so it's a good time for me to recount some of the always ongoing retro gaming that I get up to. That, you know, if you're lucky, you don't have to hear about, but this week you're unlucky. So, first of all, a couple of weeks ago on the Japanese Virtual Console, I finally got Blaster Master.
Oh, yes!
Under its original title of something fight. Like Super Planetary War Records Meta Fight, I think is the full translation of the title.
Oh.
And it does do away, obviously, with it. It doesn't do away with it because that's backwards. But, you know, in the Western version, there's that whole bizarre plot thing of the frog and all that nonsense. So
the boy, Jason. Yeah.
Yeah, that all that wasn't in the Japanese version.
So basically, the Japanese version, you turn it on, you press start, you're in the tank.
And the killing begins.
You see a tank kind of blast off into the scenery, and then the game begins, yeah.
And really, that's all you really need.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, for an NES game?
Well, it's called Super Planetary War Records Meta Fight. I mean, come on. How do you build a story around that?
It's a fight, but is it?
Yes. It's just over your head.
Greg, I would predict that you would really like Blaster Master, aka
Yeah, exactly. Everything I had heard was that it, you know, it sounded really the kind of thing I would enjoy. You know, it is obviously a sort of non-linear, kind of somewhat exploratory kind of Metroid-y thing, but it does have lives, a little bit like... Mega Man ZX.
With less punishment.
But you know what it's actually reminded me of just in the very early stages that I've played of it? Is Robot Ninja Hagelman 3 from Retro Game Challenge. I mean, aesthetically, even a little bit in terms of the color palette, but you're having lives, kind of the way the levels are designed. You know, it's not that obvious exactly where you're supposed to be going. You know, the levels designs aren't kind of like funneling you down certain areas.
Maybe we should clarify real quickly. Robot Ninja Hagelman 3 is one of the games contained within Retro Game Challenge. It is the best reason to own Retro Game Challenge.
It's good fun. I really like that part of it. It's completely different from the previous two Robot Ninja Hagelman games.
I'd be
getting into that a little bit, haven't really got too far. That'll be something that'll be ongoing. But also, got a couple of PS1 games from the PSN. The first one I'm going to talk about very briefly is Castlevania Chronicles.
Is this really a PS1 game? I mean, isn't it kind of a port of a Super Famicom game or something?
It's a port of a X68000 game.
Yeah, I actually have this somewhere buried.
The original?
PS1. Weird.
Yeah.
It's under Choaniki.
It came out.
Oh,
of course.
It came out in the twilight of the kind of PS1 era for about $20. I think it was a budget title in America. But it's really fun. It's actually got like this weird extra on it where it's an interview with Igarashi talking about why they made this game. And he looks so different because he hadn't grown his hair out and started wearing leather hats yet.
Oh, really? And he didn't have the whip?
No, he just looks kind of normal.
Did he
just
whip the camera?
Just like a tall Japanese man. It was very, very disappointing that the mystique was not there.
It was before he had gone completely insane.
So the game that it comes from, which is, like I said, for this sort of Sharp-made computer in Japan, I think the game was made in about 1993 originally, and it's pretty much a straight port, except with a marginally less ridiculous character sprite. Which basically changes Simon Belmont away from being like shades of brown like he was in the NES game to having like flaming red hair.
And on the box of the PS1 game, because I remember seeing it, his hair blends in with like the bloody background and shit.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's odd, that part. So there's this sort of remix version that has, you know, different music. The music of the original version actually sounds a shitload like Castlevania Rebirth. Or the other way around, really.
I think Rebirth has good music, actually.
Yeah, but in terms of the synth quality kind of twangy quality, like it sounds quite a bit like Genesis, but it sounds more like this. Actually, the arranged stuff's not bad, but it came at a similar time to Rondo of Blood, basically. But it is probably the least progressive Castlevania game made after the original Castlevania. I mean, if you think that Rondo of Blood is too old school for you, then this is nothing you should even consider touching. Because you can't jump on stairs, you can't jump off stairs. You do have, you know, some control over your movements in the air, but other than that, yeah, there's no item crashes or multi-directional whipping or multiple routes or any.
It makes the Super Castlevania look like Quantum Leap Forward, basically.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it was kind of at the time sort of like a remake of the first one, not really in terms of the level designs. Are mostly different, you know, but the settings are kind of similar. But in terms of gameplay, it's very much the first one again.
I'm a little surprised that you picked this up, Greg, because I remember when Castlevania Chronicles first came out, reading about it, probably in EGM.
It was panned.
It was really panned a lot. Basically, they said it's like way old school, and we should be getting Rondo of Blood in America, but instead we're getting this piece of shit, and it belongs more in the 80s than it does in the 90s.
Exactly. I mean, you know, it's not well thought of, but I'm a big Castlevania fan. I like to play everything I can of it, and I'm okay with the 8-bit ones. That's the thing. You know, I can still play the first one and enjoy it. And so this is kind of like doing that with prettier graphics.
This is the 8-bit one for a system that had 10 megabytes of memory.
Yeah,
so and a 10 megahertz processor.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a sort of anachronism, really, in many ways. You know, it's a game originally made in the 90s that gameplay-wise comes from the 80s but came out in the new millennium, and now I'm playing it in 2010. So
it's Back to the Future, Greg Leahy.
So yeah, this is for your Castlevania diehards, of which I am one. But where I'm currently at is probably the most heinous clock tower level ever made. It is quite difficult.
I bet it's super fun with the jumping as constrained as it is.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I mean, even Castlevania Rebirth, a deliberately retro game, is thoroughly modern compared to this.
Oh, because people would kill themselves.
But there's another one, another PS1 classic that I picked up was R-Type Delta. So this is one of sort of a whole generation of side-scrolling shoot-em-ups that came out on the PS1 and Saturn. That
yeah.
no one gave a shit about over
right,
here.
Right, along
in
with Einhander and...
Yes!
Yeah, Einhander, G. Darius, Thunder Force 5, Gradius Gaiden. There's a whole bunch of them in famous shoot-em-up series. Obviously, Einhander was original.
Yeah, it was kind of like, why the hell is... I mean, it was so oddball for Square Enix, too. Like
Einhander's pretty... Einhander, I think, actually got a little more attention than a lot of those other ones.
It
because
did.
It had 3D graphics, had political, you know, polygon graphics. But it doesn't really play any differently
yeah,
than
well,
any other
Yeah, well, I mean, it's Sony also featured it prominently, even putting it in all their demo kiosks.
Yeah, it was in demos. Because it was Square, it just got a lot more press, actually. I mean, the R-Type Delta, for instance, has polygonal graphics as well. It plays, you know, strictly 2D.
Yeah, but there were a million R-Type games, so it didn't get the kind of press this one got.
Well, there's not that many.
I think it's just that it was never really a big hit in the U.S., and also it was... really, really fucking hard. Every R-Type game is, like, fucking impossible.
R-Type is very, very difficult as a series. And this one's been pretty hard so far from what I've played. But it is polygonal. Obviously, it looks kind of rough now in terms of, you know, the textures are a bit harsh. And the chunky kind of polygonal stuff fits okay with the R-Type aesthetic, actually. It's not a bad match, but I'm sure that it would have held up better if they'd actually gone for sprite-based graphics like Gradius Gaiden did. That looks quite a lot prettier in retrospect, but at the time it let them do some flashy things with perspective and things coming in and out of the screen and stuff, so, you know, I can understand why they did it. But in terms of the gameplay, it's you know, pretty similar to the other R-Type games. Like, you do have, like, different ships you could choose which have different power-ups that you can get. One of the wrinkles that I really like, which addresses one of my problems with the sort of classic shooter series like Gradius and R-Type, is the whole speed-up mechanic is different. Because typically in Gradius and R-Type, you really need speed-ups. Like, they are completely essential. Your basic rate of travel is so slow that you have no chance, especially when you're restarting at a checkpoint on a harder level. So the first thing you have to do is kill stuff to get speed-ups. But then what will happen is you get a certain amount of speed-ups, and God forbid you get any more, because then you're just too fast to do anything.
I like that tension. I like the idea of, like, you might accidentally get a power-up that fucks you over.
But more so even than that, what I really don't like is the fact that, yeah, you know, you need to be so fast for certain situations, but then in other situations, like, you don't want to be that fast. You want to be able to do sort of fine adjustments, and you pretty much can't. But what you've got in R-Type Delta is the ability to just modulate your speed using the shoulder buttons. So it's just that, you know, if I want to go faster, I can click up through a bunch of speed settings and then click down according to the situation, and that I feel just adds another layer to the gameplay, whereby, you know, there is quite a lot of variance in the sort of situations that you're facing. You know, sometimes, like, for instance you're facing a boss that's, you know, hitting you with, like, loads of giant beams, you want that fine control to make sure that you maintain, you know, your position relative to those beams as they move around, whereas other times when you try sort of zipping all across the screen trying to, you know, take out enemies before they get to you and stuff like that, you want the speed. I think it's a great way of sort of keeping the gameplay a bit more involved rather than just blast. You know, having to think about it and manipulating it in that way. To be honest, I'm just really surprised it isn't in more shoot-em-ups. It seems quite logical.
I'd kill for that kind of control in, like, you know, any Gradius game, pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would have benefited from it. I'm not sure whether stuff like Gaiden did that as well or not, because I haven't played that, although it's meant to be very good.
It's only... Right now, I think the easiest way to play Gradius Gaiden is on PSP.
PSP.
On the collection.
For some reason, it's not even out in Japan's PSN service, which has many, many more PS1 games than any other region, including some of the really obscure shooter stuff like Thunder Force 5, but it does not have Gaiden for whatever reason.
So I remember when R-Type Delta first came out, at least in the US. And
yeah, this is one that did come over and like quite a lot of them.
It did, yeah, and it got really good reviews, and I remember thinking, man, that sounds great. I wonder if I should get it. And then I remembered that I've never, and to this day, I don't think I've ever finished a level in an R-Type game.
Oh, no.
A level?
A level?
I don't think I have ever finished
a level. I finished one at like 6, come on! Get on the bus!
No, I definitely in R-Type 3. That's the one I've played the most, or I've tried the most times.
The third lightning.
Yeah.
I know for a fact that I have never beaten the first boss in R-Type 3.
It's quite a hard first level, that one, I suppose.
Craig's like, don't worry. We're not going to laugh too hard.
I've beaten Gradius 5 and I've beaten Gradius through the code, but I've beaten Gradius 5 legitimately.
Mm.
I've gotten to the 5th level in Ikaruga. Like, I'm not shitty at shoot-em-ups, but there's something about R-Type that doesn't click with me.
In my experience, R-Type games are pretty extreme in their difficulty in shooters. I've played a shitload of shooters, especially since I got the Japanese virtual console star. I've played so many. And the R-Type still stands out some of the hardest stuff, because I mean, like, they get hard early and that breaks your will, I think, a lot of the time, you know, like I was playing the sort of arcade version of the second game. The second level is like probably the hardest second level I've ever played in a video game. It's ridiculous. And Super R-Type is similarly difficult, except it slows down so much it makes it easier. That's pretty much the only thing that saves that from being equally as hard.
Because of actual slowdown?
Well, yeah, Gradius 3 is the same way.
Yeah, I mean, Super R-Type actually came out quite a bit later than Gradius 3, and it's still painful. Yeah. It's like absolutely
Super Nintendo, not a powerhouse for shooting.
No,
games.
But I mean, R-Type 3 shows that you can do it a lot better, because Super R-Type scrolls like a MSX game. It's so bad. It's ridiculous. But R-Type Delta, like I said, it's got quite a slow pace to it. Slower, certainly, than the arcade R-Type games, I think, because you're dealing with this kind of chunky polygonal kind of environment. So with the speed manipulation, with the different power-ups, and with the deliberate pace, it feels, you know, less of like a sort of frenetic bullet hell kind of shooter, and more of a kind of thoughtful but still, you know, challenging and very skill leverage shooter. And so far I've been pretty pleased with the level scenarios. The one I'm up to at the minute is like the third level, is basically a riff on the giant battleship levels that you have in pretty much every R-Type game, if you can get there. But in this case, it's like one of the walkers from Star Wars as a giant battleship. So it's really cool. It's just, obviously, I really enjoyed so many shoot-em-ups on the Super NES, even though they were, you know, a bit challenged in terms of coping with the pace and everything. But then, of course, when you get to N64, nothing. And, you know, I was just an N64 guy. I never had a PlayStation or a Saturn. So all the shooters that admittedly got less and less attention because people just didn't care about the genre anymore, you know, I was completely cut off from them. And it's kind of cool to reconnect with the sort of evolution of the genre as it went. And I will say, if there's one game I want to play that I haven't in video game history right now, it's Radiant Silvergun. I would kill for that.
Me too.
Yes, me three.
They're talking about Saturn emulation, or if we can get that, that would be awesome. I've played most of Treasure's back catalogue at this point, but that is a huge gaping hole.
Yeah, I hope it's on PSN eventually.
Yeah.
There were actually a couple of pretty good shooters on N64 that just didn't come to America. I mean, you have the original Bengayo.
Yeah, that was like 50,000 copies in Japan. I mean, it was even for someone who was importing games like me, that was hard to get hold of.
Yeah, it was expensive.
And I mean, you can count Sin and Punishment, which is a bit different.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, but that also did not come to America. And that came out in 2000, so it was a really late... really late N64 game. And then there's also, and I need your help, guys, but it's the Hudson series.
Star Soldier,
yeah. There's a Star Soldier game for N64 that I've played somehow. And yeah. So there were a few in Japan, but pretty much
indeed.
None of them came to the US, unfortunately. So anyway, that's going to end new business. We managed to sneak in a couple of Nintendo games in there. So we're going to do a quick little piece on Mother 3. This is our retroactive, our 13th retroactive feature. Mother 3 won the big poll of the six GBA games that I nominated, or that, well, that were nominated. I chose the nominees, but some of them were user requests. Mother 3 won. Of course, this is the sequel to Earthbound, and it has not come to the West yet, or probably ever. So we're playing with a fan translation. You could also play if you read Japanese. That would be a suitable alternative, but we don't. Well, James, you don't really read Japanese, do you?
Not much.
Not enough to play this.
No.
Not for an RPG. Yeah. So anyway, Mother 3, we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on it this week, because as an RPG, it takes a while to ramp up, as you might imagine. And we've played varying amounts of it. So we're going to kind of get some first impressions out the door here. And then in 2 weeks from now, we're going to come back. I think we're going to try to get Neil on board, because Neil's played the entire game. We'll be much farther into it, and we'll be able to talk about it at a higher level, I think. But I figured it was worthwhile to kind of check in right now. We have all played the game. Greg has barely touched it, so he's actually sitting out for this part of the show. But I hope he'll be back in a couple weeks with at least something to say about it. I can't guarantee that, because he's a very busy man. So anyway, want to take a crack at Mother 3, get some of the initial stuff out of the way so that when we come back in a couple weeks, we can really get into the meat of it. So first impressions, James and John, what you think?
I'm enjoying it so far. I think it's really, really humorous. I kind of forgot. The thing is, you have to bear in mind that I never actually played the first Earthbound. It was funny. I actually bought Earthbound right...
Of course.
No, well, it was... Like, I bought it. I found it cheap at Walmart, and... I really didn't know anything about it, but at the time, you know, I was playing a lot of RPGs. But I kind of bought it, like, at the end of the Super NES's lifespan. I mean, like, it was on clear out at Walmart.
I bought it in the early 2000s.
Yeah. And so I just never... I kind of bought it at a time when I kind of just stopped playing my Super NES altogether. So I never really got to... I never played through the whole game, which is surprising. I mean, usually with all of my Super NES titles, I played the hell out of them. So this is kind of one of those series where it's, you know, I've heard only good things about it, and I played Earthbound. I think I played it just like tiny, tiny bit. And so this is kind of my first experience really actually playing through an Earthbound title. And it's kind of everything I figured it would be, very tongue-in-cheek, very different. I mean, for example, the fact that you save your game by talking to frogs, perfect example, pretty wacky.
In Earthbound, you picked up a telephone and called your dad.
Yes.
And you told him, Dad, I would like to save my game.
Yeah. Yes. Yep.
And that was right after he gave you your allowance over the phone.
Yes, you got an allowance over the phone.
And he deposited it directly into your ATM account.
Yep.
I think from what I've played so far, Mother 3 is less overtly contemporary than Earthbound. Earthbound was all like, this game is taking place in the year 1995.
Mm-hmm. ATMs exist.
Right. ATMs and telephones and, you know, all this shit.
Allowances.
TVs, allowances, right. Earthbound, I mean, there's a lot of psychedelic insanity in Earthbound 2, but it was kind of set in this idea of like modern America at that time, whereas Mother 3 is not really in America. You can tell it's not so much a direct parody of America.
It's closer to like Pokemon's representation of Japan.
I agree. Mother 3 feels like it's set more in its own world, like an original place and time, and it's not so based on some
where you talk
know,
to fucking animals and they save your game. Yes.
Right. I mean, talking to frogs to save is a great example of how this is. Mother 3 feels a little more naturalistic than Earthbound. Earthbound was all about like the technology
I think it feels more like licking frogs to come up with your game story than being naturalistic.
Well, I mean, I assume based on the level in Brawl, Smash Brothers Brawl, I assume that at some point we're going to visit some giant metropolis city, and maybe there you get more contemporary references. But so far, Mother 3, it's kind of set in this small village that's, you know, sort of lost in time. They don't even use money. That comes later, I think. But in this town, there's a store where you just walk in and take things for free.
It's communism games.
So, James, what are your first impressions?
So I'm only about maybe 2 hours in, And the first 2 hours are unmercifully boring.
Yeah, it starts out really slow.
I mean, I've played a lot of RPGs. They don't start this slow. I mean,
yeah, it's slower than Earthbound, for sure.
This is the slowest game I've played in a long time.
It does pick up, though.
It's like I spent 4 minutes walking around looking for a fucking map. It's like, you need to find the guy with the map. His name is Mapton. It's like, his name is Mapton, and he gives maps. That is some creative naming by his parents. And then it's like, okay, now walk through a place with fire in it. Okay, just keep walking. Don't step on anything. My personal favorite, though, is the healing mechanism coming back of you have to sit in the hot springs for 5 seconds.
Yeah, you can't just step into it. You have to go in there and stop.
And if you try to step out, the game chides you for being impatient. It's like, who made this? Honestly.
There are other ways to heal. But, well, actually, I think one thing that I noticed very early on is that you use a lot of items in this game.
Yeah, because there's no healing. I mean, or very
little. Like, your character, in the early part of the game, your character doesn't have healing spells or anything, and there's not really an inn. So, aside from that hot spring, the only way to heal yourself is to use items, you know, to eat food. And the enemies, I mean, there's a lot of it. The enemies drop a lot of items. You find them in gift boxes all over the, you know, treasure chests. But I was just surprised because in most RPGs, you know, your Final Fantasies, your Dragon Quest, you find items, but a lot of times you only use them in emergencies.
Yeah. You can hoard them. You can just stack them.
I mean,
in Mother 3, like, you're constantly getting items and using them all the time.
I just spoke about the Tales games and why I like them, and the reason is because you constantly are regenerating your TP, your technical points, which is the MP of this game. So your healer is basically just throwing healing spells the entire game, and you never have to use items until you get to a boss battle. And so it's like, well, this game, it's like you have to use items pretty much from the start because that fucking fly does 10 damage and you've only got 80 life.
Right. Yeah. I mean, after every one or two battles, you're going to have to heal up. And, you know, until you learn a spell, then the way you do that is you eat some crackers or cookies or nuts.
Nut bread.
There's a lot of that early on. So what were your expectations going in? I mean, John, you said you had really very little context in terms of Earthbound, but James, you've played Earthbound, right?
Yes, I did not enjoy Earthbound, actually. I just, for whatever reason, that game was just felt like it was being weird for weird's sake a lot of times, and it just never clicked with me. I always felt like the combat system was relatively slow. Even amongst its peers, it was kind of a slow game.
Yeah, I always felt like I could never really get a handle from what I did play of Earthbound. I could never really get a handle of who they were trying to reach out to with it. Who they were trying to appeal to.
Japan. I mean, it was a satire of games in Japan.
Yeah, it was so weird. I mean, it was...
Right. It is a parody of Japanese RPGs.
Yeah.
Yeah, and part of doing that, one of the things they did is they made the game very slow.
Very slow, very difficult. I mean, it is a parody of Dragon Quest, basically.
Yeah.
Earthbound. Mother 2. I think Mother 3 actually steps away from that and is less interested in being a parody of other games. And it's more interested in telling its own story and kind of doing its own thing. So in some cases, it's less weird because of that, I think. A little bit less weird.
I mean, it's still a slow game. By comparison, some of its contemporaries back then, turn-based RPGs, there's not like a bunch of detailed art in the battle system. It's very much like the original Final Fantasy in that the characters are in two separate boxes, and when you attack, damage happens, but one person swings in one box and they receive damage in the other.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, no, it's more like the old Dragon Quest games where it's first person and select from your menus, but you never really see your character during battle. I mean, you kind of see them in Mother 3, but they just kind of pop up from the bottom. You don't normally see them. It's just kind of to give an indication of who's attacking at any given time. But I guess my expectations for it were that I've played almost all of Earthbound, probably twice. I don't know that I've actually beaten it, but I've played the vast majority of that game more than once, and I own a copy of it. It's in the attic back home. And I really like Earthbound. And maybe it's not surprising because I really like the 16-bit RPGs that it's making fun of. So I get the jokes, but I also appreciate the fact that it doesn't just do the same shit. You know, it's not just another Japanese RPG. It's actually set in a different place, in a different time. The characters behave differently. And especially at the time when Earthbound came out, it did a lot of things that other Japanese RPGs weren't doing. Like, you can see the enemies before you get into battle, and you can avoid them, or you can sneak up behind them and get, you know, first strike. It plays weird tricks with, like, you know, the way your hit points dial down. And so if an enemy does mortal damage to you, but you run away or you kill the enemy before your hit points run out, then you survive. And that carries over into Mother 3. I also like a lot of the stuff in Earthbound where it's a little bit like Golden Sun in that it felt like you were doing more between battles. Like there was more interaction with the world. So, you know, there's the stuff like with the spell that you learn or the psi power that you learn in Earthbound to teleport from between places. Mm-hmm. You actually have to run in the world. Like you have to have enough space to actually use that power. So you have to find a place in the world where you have this long runway, basically, so you can get up enough speed. It's like Back to the Future. You have to get up to 88 miles per hour so you can teleport to another place. And then later on, you learn an upgraded version where you can just run in circles to do the same thing. I think that's great. And I'm not far enough in Mother 3 to know if there's something similar to that or if it takes another step in that direction. But I really appreciate that kind of unique perspective on RPGs in that not only are we making fun of other RPGs, but we're also going to innovate and do things that other RPGs aren't doing.
Well, it's kind of a blend of an action game, you know, action elements in there where, you know, space matters, how, like, what you're doing, right. Your technique kind of matters.
Right. I wouldn't call it an action RPG. It's no Zelda for sure, mm-hmm. But there's a little more interaction with the world than you get in a lot of other Japanese RPGs. But my expectations going into Mother 3, I don't know. I was looking forward to meeting the characters because I knew there would be a lot of crazy, funny characters. And I thought that the story would be totally wacky and over the top and just silly. And I guess one way that it's so far that it's already subverted my expectations is that the story, it definitely has like silly elements, you know, like the bad guys, apparently they wear pig masks. You know, there's dinosaurs for some reason,
yeah.
And, you know, there's a little bit of Dragon Ball Z there where it's like these characters inexplicably live in a place where dinosaurs are commonplace, you know, or whatever. But I've been surprised by how serious the story can be. James, you've probably seen this, John. There's a kind of a tragedy that happens pretty early in the game that definitely surprised me. I wasn't expecting that, and it kind of makes you take the game more seriously after that. And the things that happen, you're like, well, there might be this mask of wackiness over it, but underneath that, the game takes itself pretty seriously, and it feels like it's actually trying to tell an emotional story. And because of that, I actually feel like the wackiness part, it is like a mask. It's almost like a self-defense mechanism. It's like Itoi, Shigesato Itoi, the guy who wrote this, it's like he wants to tell a serious story, but he's afraid of being taken too seriously. So it's like he wears this mask of like, oh, I'm so silly, I'm such a clown. But underneath it, he's actually really, really concerned with telling a serious story. And I don't know how serious it's going to get. I'm still only in Chapter 3. But from what I've seen on the forums, from, you know, some of the people who've played farther than me, it sounds like there's some, like, fucked up shit that goes on later on. You know, like, really surprising stuff. And I'm looking forward to that, because, that's something you didn't really get in Earthbound.
Yeah, I mean, is it the kind of thing where he's trying to kind of tell a serious story, but through the eyes of a child? Which is done in movies, really, but not too much in video games.
Right, it's almost like a Pan's Labyrinth kind of thing,
yeah.
Right? Like, there's some fucked up shit going on, but this child can't really process it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you end up applying these, like, fantasy elements to it to kind of help explain and try to help process your emotions that are too big for you, mm-hmm. as a child. Yeah, I think that is probably a very legitimate interpretation of maybe the entire Mother series, but especially Mother 3 from what I've seen so far.
Yeah, well, I find that, I mean, it's so silly right off the bat that you can kind of almost, I wouldn't say it's predictable, but you're kind of like, okay, you're just kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop. Like, is it always going to be this silly? Because it can't be this silly for really no
right.
reason for the entire
game. It's gonna drop. Play a little more, and it's going to drop. It drops so hard that I don't think it can go back to being totally silly.
Yeah. Well, it seems so purposeful. The
right.
silliness seems not contrived, but it seems like it's getting at something.
Right. And in Earthbound, and this could be, you know, the North American, maybe this was just Nintendo's localization of it, but in Earthbound, I feel like it never really got serious. Like, it always felt like it was building up to some kind of serious twist,
mm-hmm.
and I never really felt like it did, whereas Mother 3 hits it right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the problem I had with Earthbound is, look, there is an alien invasion, but they're all stupid and goofy.
Yeah.
It's like, well, honestly, let these fuckers try to conquer everything. They're idiots. I mean, yeah. Fuck, they're going to screw it up. I know it's going to happen.
Yeah, they're kind of like the Coneheads.
They kind of were. I mean, it never felt menacing. So I was like, why does a little kid have to run around and deal with this crap?
Yeah.
It's even a psychic
I think the
kid.
Stakes are higher in Mother 3 right off the bat. That excites me. That makes me really curious to see what happens as the game goes on. The other thing, and we got to wrap this up, but the other thing that's really interesting that you can tell from the early chapters is that the structure of this is very much like Dragon Quest IV, where it's pretty obvious that Lucas is the star of the game, and yet you don't play him until much later in the game. So the early chapters are, you're looking at all these characters who are kind of tangential to Lucas's story. You know, you see him, he comes in and out of the story through these early chapters, but you're playing side characters, and they're not going to stick around. Which is weird in an RPG, because you're playing a character, like, in chapter one, you're playing as Flint, and that character is not going to stick around. So it doesn't matter how much you level him up. Leveling him up and making him learn a lot of cool abilities and getting the best armor for him, none of that matters in the end. So really the point is to survive to the end of the chapter and see what happens and then move on. Because then it's going to reset. Now you're playing chapter two as a different character and you're seeing things from a different perspective. And so on until finally you get to Lucas. And that's basically, I guess, where the game's going to start. But by then you kind of have all this backstory, all this context built up for what he's doing. Very different approach from Earthbound Mother 2. Where, you know, you start off as Ness and you play the whole game as Ness. It's very straightforward RPG stuff. This takes a much more layered approach to the storytelling and the character development. Okay, well, that's going to wrap up the initial cut at Mother 3. Obviously, we are very early in the game. It's not a short game, so we're going to give it a couple more weeks and hopefully play through a lot more. I hope those of you at home listening and playing along will get farther as well. We have this great forum thread building up. It's a small but devoted following of people who are playing along with it. And if you have the means and the interest to play a game like this, I hope you will check it out and leave your comments. And when we come back in a couple weeks, we'll talk about the later parts of the game. We'll really get into the meat of it, and we'll be reading some of the comments that people have been posting there in the thread. So check it out, and stay tuned for the conclusion of this retroactive in a couple of weeks. So now we're going to take a break, and we'll come back with awesome listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Alright, we have a review of Sin and Punishment Star Successor by Neil, calling it one of the best retail release shooters in recent memory. Read Neil's review to see if he could find anything wrong with the long-awaited sequel to the N64 classic.
According to Garnet on Wicked Confirmed, the thing that's wrong with it is the Wii remote controls.
Yeah,
no accounting for taste.
Also in the review side, we have SteamWorld Tower Defense, as reviewed by Matt, because no one else would review SteamWorld Tower Defense. Matt finds that while this tower defense game sticks pretty true to the genre traditions, i.e. it's a tower defense game, it is, quote, one of the better of the bunch of the recent crop of tower defense games.
Another portable review, Neil takes a look at Lego Harry Potter for DS. He really liked the amount of content in the game, but he warns that it may only appeal to fans of the series. Find out if it's for you by reading his review.
In the blogosphere, Neil takes a look back at Red Steel 2, Mad World, and Punch Out! He examines whether or not he has any regrets about the review scores he assigned to these games. Does he stand by his scores, or does he admit that he's a raving fanboy?
Punch-Out is still one of my favorite games from last year. Loved it.
It's good.
I'm not saying anything about the other two.
Also, there's a new, very good episode of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition with TYP and Carl Castaneda making his return to Radio Trivia after 3 years hiatus.
So I assume he takes the time to recount his Grapple Dem Titty story there, too?
No.
He talks about the fact that TYP won the Pulitzer for writing an article called Why the World Doesn't Need Carl Castaneda.
Among the games played on this episode, there's one in particular which I will not identify explicitly, but let's just say this is a game Carl likes a lot.
This is so hard to guess what this might be. We wouldn't want to give away the surprise.
Nope.
Right.
It's that that Pyonga golf game, right?
No, that's Stan.
Battalion Wars 2, Fire Emblem, has to go.
We'll never know how much Carl likes this game.
Yes, check out the excellent new episode of Radio Trivia for that game by Carl and a bunch of listener requests that are really good. All right, we are back for segment two. It's time for listener mail. And, you know, a couple weeks ago, I put out the call and I said, if you've never written in before, I want you to pick up that phone and make the call.
Call Cobra.
And people did with their keyboards.
You know who to call.
Yeah, I mean, the past week, the emails that we've gotten, I feel like I'm running a happy birthday, Bart. I mean, we've gotten such great emails. And what I really like is that people write in and say, I've been listening since episode 89. I've never written in before, but here you go. Including Chris in Minneapolis. John, I believe this is your email.
Hey, guys, your podcast always entertains me when I'm traveling around and you make the time pass quicker. I will be traveling to London next month and was wondering if you can recommend any DS games that aren't available here in America to buy while I'm there. I enjoy a good variety of games, some of my favorites being RPGs, the Layton series, and Phoenix Wright and the Phoenix Wright series.
Based on Chris's taste in RPGs, Professor Layton, and Phoenix Wright, I'm going to come out and say Disaster Day of Crisis.
But that's not for the DS. Mission failed.
I would say Choaniki.
So, Greg, you're really the expert here on this question. It's really to you.
I mean, it's difficult. There's actually been probably more games as like Disaster or Trace Memory, you know, another Kodar, that have come to Europe on Wii. We do, of course, have the exciting news from last week. The Face Training is on the way. Unfortunately, that will be...
And there's Jam with the Band.
Yeah, Jam with the Band would be the first thing that we have discussed that came out in May. If you can find somewhere to get Amazon UK to deliver it to while you're here, you're going to get it really cheap.
You'll get it for free.
Send it to your hotel. Really.
Yeah.
That works.
I think that could well be worth
looking into. You
could
have it next day, but it would cost you more than the game.
But yeah, there's a weird problem going on at the minute where, like, you know, like if you try and download certain songs, it just gives you an error message, whereas others you can download.
Yes, and then you get stuck with songs you didn't want testing the download service.
Yeah, because remember, you only have so many downloads to use.
It's a trick to make you get the shit games.
Maybe. People aren't downloading enough of the James Bond theme, so we'll just stop them from downloading this Nintendo crap, and you'll have you to a killer like it.
It's a trap.
The Bon. Simon the Bon.
The Bon. Terrible.
Actually, in the video, that happened.
Yeah, I have a serious answer to this question. If we go back several years, some games that, certainly when I eventually go to England, as I have wanted to do my entire life, a couple of games that I'll be looking for, maybe in the more obscure gaming stores, not something you're going to see out on the front shelves, but games that from the previous generation that we did not get in North America, Kuru Kuru Kururin and Kuru Paradise, which is the sequel, which I've heard Paradise is the much better game. There's apparently a lot more to it, but yeah. Anyway, the Kuru games... I've always wanted to play. I've never really played them, and I think I played a demo at like E3 somewhere. Maybe I played TYP's copies sometime, but I would love to pick up one of those. And I know they were released in Europe and not America, so that would be probably the first place I would start. I don't know. That's pretty obscure stuff, but...
So, Greg, are you out? Because I got one.
Go for it.
And I think it actually does kind of mesh with what he's looking for. The Tingle Magical Colored Rupee Land.
Yeah, that's right. That was quite a few years ago now, but maybe you'll still be able to find it. Could be tricky.
I think that would go well with what he put in there as his interests, too, because that game is fucked.
It sounds really, really odd, doesn't it?
It's so bizarre. Like, everything I read about it, I'm like, that really happened.
It's basically all about rupees. Like, yes. you pay people to fight for you. Your health is rupees.
Yes.
You dump rupees into this, like, pyramid scheme, basically. It sounds,
so
seems
bizarre.
Like. It's a really funny one. Although, the sequel in Japan has not been localized.
No, it hasn't.
Here.
Yet.
Well, yeah, to be honest, the way they're starting to do things on some 2-year lag, I'm not ruling it out.
It's going
to
come out when the 3DS is 3 years old.
One thing I really hope that Europe does localize on DS and on a bizarre lag is that newer Chibi-Robo game.
Oh, yeah.
The one that wasn't Park Patrol, but was more, it was actually more like the console version.
Right.
Where you're in a house and he's got like this little vacuum cleaner that he uses and stuff. It's got pretty good reviews from in Japan, and you know, from a few people that have imported it, says good. And having played Chibi-Robo on Wii and enjoyed it a lot, the Japanese new play control version, I just think it'd be perfect as a portable game.
Rich Big Sweep, yes.
That's it.
Welcome home, like, Chibi-Robo. Happy Rich Big Sweep. That's the literal
title.
The
one thing that I think completely ensures that that wouldn't get released in America is apparently there's a shitload of gambling in it. We kind of have a laid-back attitude to gambling here compared to America, so maybe it's possible.
I have a laid-back attitude
to
gambling.
Well, as long as it's not gambling on sports, then I think we're okay.
Greg, what was that fucking hamster or chinchilla game that you reviewed?
The Hurry Up Hedgehog. I think that came out.
That came out
in the
US.
Anyway.
It did. Yes.
And you
really?
Do not want to go within a 3/4 mile radius of that game. I think Chris is already risking it, leaving the safety of the Twin Cities and coming to England.
Speaking of horrible infection games, people of Urbana, Illinois. I have it on good word that King of Clubs has arrived.
It's touchdown. The hazmat team's been dispatched.
He could go like really hardcore and pick up like a Spectrum or something, like an old system.
I don't know how many of those you're gonna buy.
Why not? I mean, if you're like a collector, that would be awesome to pick up like a Europe only system, you know, and you could get all those old rare games. Like if you wanted to play the original Saberwolf and some of the other old rare games,
when they were ultimate, play the game.
Yeah, that would be really cool, I think.
But, I mean, it's obviously DS and portable games are always the thing to look for when you're abroad, because they will actually work, and you know that for sure.
Well, let's be careful now, because DSi games are region-locked.
DSi games, yeah, but, I mean, there's very few...
How many DSi cartridge games are there?
Well, Face Training will be a DSi-specific game, because they're they're not using the accessory. They're just... They're going to use the onboard camera for this release, obviously, when it came back. When it came out in Japan, there was no such thing as the DSi.
Right. So, I mean, it's not many games, but it is important to note, if you're going to go buy, Photo Show, and then come back to Europe, you're fucked.
Heartbreaking.
Now, if you buy that game, you're fucked anyway.
Okay, well, moving on, I guess I have the next email. It's from Austin from Minnesota, and he writes, I don't recall whether or not any of you own PSPs, but I recently purchased one with the Metal Gear Solid Peace Walker bundle. My question to you is as follows, Do you know of or have you played any PSP games that you think would appeal to a Nintendo fan? Any suggestions would be much appreciated. Thanks, and keep up the great work.
Patapon 2. Get Patapon 2.
Okay. That's one of the first ones I would get if and when I get a PSP.
Other stuff, maybe if you like F-Zero, you might try some of the, like, I think Wipeout Pulse. The Wipeout games tend to be really good. They're sort of generic when compared to, like, F-Zero. They don't have as many... Like, you know, they don't have all the characters and everything, but...
I feel like Wipeout is a little loose compared to F-Zero.
Yeah, I haven't played... I haven't played the one on the PSP. The one on PSN is amazing. Wipeout HD, it's great.
I've been thinking about that for a long time. I haven't got around to it yet.
It's really, really good.
I'd say the PSP games that I would probably get first, if and when I do get a PSP... Patapon 2, definitely up there. Also, the Mega Man remake?
Powered Up.
Yeah, that's it. Powered Up.
I've heard that's amazing. It's like a remake of the original Mega Man, but, like, they made it playable.
That game was imminently playable. I don't know what you're talking about.
I would love to check that out.
Yeah, there's a few stuff like for if you like really old school games, like, I mean, you've got, was it Ultimate Ghosts and Goblins? Is there,
yeah.
Which is a bit quite divisive game. You know, I remember Edge gave it a really good review. Parrish hated it.
When is Ghosts and Goblins not divisive?
Exactly.
Yeah, really. Well, since when do we cite Edge reviews as being authoritative either?
You probably know which side of the fence you're on with that one, so maybe that could be a big plus. And then, as we kind of mentioned in New Business, there's the Gradius Collection.
Sure,
you can get with
yeah.
if you like old school shooters and stuff.
Choiniki
so.
Zero.
Yeah.
I don't know if that appeals to a Nintendo fan.
Should appeal to everybody.
Appeals to fans of something.
Children of all ages should be playing that game right now.
All children have to play Choiniki.
There's a very good remake of Final Fantasy Tactics called The Lion's War on
there's
PSP.
There's also a fantastic remake, apparently it's going to be fantastic at least, of the awesome, fantastic Ogre Battle SNES game.
I think it's actually Tactics Ogre.
Tactics Ogre.
Tactics Ogre, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. It is Tactics Ogre. Let Us Cling Together, which they're going to rename, at least in Japan, the Wheel of Destiny.
Great.
Yeah.
They're doing away with the Queen titles.
Yeah.
So Tactics Ogre for Super Famicom never came out in the US, as far as I know.
Right.
It was ported to PS1 and also still never came out to America on the PS1.
It is a fantastic game, though. Just take my word for it.
And then there's the GBA game, The Night of Lotus.
Which is not as fantastic a game.
I had that, and I thought it was pretty good, but it's very similar to Final Fantasy Tactics. I
mean, it is.
It's made by the same people. But I thought Final Fantasy Tactics was superior. And again, that's a series that it didn't start on a Nintendo platform. And it was a PS1 game. But now, basically probably more associated with GBA and DS, because the Final Fantasy Tactics Advance 1 and 2
right.
have been on Nintendo platforms. So if you like those, you might want to go back.
And the Revenant Wings game is very similar to a Final Fantasy Tactics game as well.
Well, you know, there's Luminous, which is very Tetris-y, mm-hmm. you know, it's Mizuguchi, so it's similar to Meteos, stuff like that. You might go for that. I don't think there's any really good platformers for PSP.
No, well, they all kind of struggle with the 2D, 3D stuff and the buttons they have.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing that really comes to mind.
I mean, I'll say on some occasions, I've certainly come to enjoy portable gaming a great deal, and I've thought, you know, there's a few things on PSP I'm interested in, and you know, maybe if you see a decent deal on one at a certain retailer, you start thinking about it, and then you start looking through the software catalogue, and it's pretty weak. I mean, not that there aren't good games for it, because there are.
I agree.
And I mean, some of the areas where it might be strong, like, you know, like certain RPG series, like, you know, you might be able to get your Persona on there or something like that. You know, so if you're into those specific series, maybe it would be
exactly.
good for you. But
that's what I was going to say. It's very polarizing.
But in terms of the genre in general, you know, DS obviously has got it beat always from Sunday.
It's like, if you like God of War, then you'll probably like the God of War games on PSP. If you don't, you will not give a
shit.
Yeah,
but that's not... God of War is not like anything on Nintendo platforms.
No, exactly.
Platforms,
but I'm just
really.
Saying that's the kind of thing. It's like the PSP, it's very like...
It's a PS2 on the go.
Yeah, it's like if you like this game on the PS3 or PS2, then, well, there you go.
So, I mean, even for whatever the games there are on it, the overlap with, like, you know, more sort of traditional gaming or Nintendo fans or stuff like that is not massive, is it?
There's, what's it called? I think it's called Work Time Fun or WTF.
Yeah.
That's a
kind of a mini game collection, right?
What about Half Minute Hero?
Half Minute Hero is another one that I would get first day one.
Yeah.
If I had a PSP. Half Minute Hero.
Yeah, and of course Monster Hunter, if you like the idea of playing that on the go.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, if you're way into Monster Hunter Tri, then PSP, that'd probably be a good place for you to go.
Yeah.
I would also say, you know, the Castlevania,
the Dracula X Chronicles.
Yep.
Yeah, so, you know, you can play Rondo of Blood in both the original, like, shittily emulated version and also the remade version with better graphics.
The polygonal version.
And then you can unlock Symphony of the Night, which I've heard is kind of like an okay port of Symphony of the Night, but at least it's portable.
Now, the one cool thing is you can, if you do have a PS3, you can download the PS1
Remote
games
play.
that are on PSN. Yeah, like right now I've downloaded, like I got Symphony of the Night on PSN on my PS3, and then I downloaded it to the PSP, and I mean it plays, it's perfect.
Oh, I would also say if you're like a really big fan of DSiWare, like Neil Ronahan, then you could pick up Pixel Junk Monsters Deluxe, which is the tower defense game that was ported from PS3 to PSP. I've heard the PSP version is very good. It has like a lot of extra content. Okay, thanks for the question. I hope we gave you some ideas, at least, for Nintendo-type games on PSP. So James has the next letter.
Right, so Brian S. writes, with many people becoming bored of the standard Guitar Hero / Rock Band formula, how do you guys think Rock Band 3 will do commercially with its, quote, pro instrument mechanic that allows the player to use real instruments to actually play the songs? And also, what are your takes on what I believe is a really neat and innovative idea?
I think Harmonix is very smart about what they're doing because they know that the casual market is pretty much over the whole music game thing. That fad has gone, basically. I think you can tell that from even Beatles Rock Band, which should have been a big hit with the casual market, and it unfortunately it wasn't.
Green Day Rock Band was a bomb. Bomb.
Yeah, Green Day bombed hard.
I mean, Activision has terminated Guitar Hero divisions because their games didn't do well.
Yeah.
Right.
And Activision fires you if your game doesn't sell well.
Right. Red Octane, the original publisher of the original Guitar Hero, basically doesn't exist anymore. It's been absorbed into the larger Activision brand. So I think Harmonix is very smart. They realize that the only people who are really interested in buying more rhythm games are like the hardcore users. And they said, okay, what do the hardcore users want out of a new game? Well, they want it to do something new that hasn't been done before, so they're not going to pay for exactly the same thing with different songs. That ship has sailed. That time is over. So we actually have to do something that we haven't done before. And also, the people who are playing this at a pretty high level are interested in actually learning to play the instruments, whereas like a very casual user is probably more interested in the fantasy of playing an instrument. So they don't really care as long as the facsimile is reasonable. You know, as long as it makes me feel like I'm playing guitar, that I don't care that I'm not, that what I'm doing has nothing to do with actually playing guitar. So I think the people who are actually left, who are actually interested in buying one of these games, really do care about playing an instrument. And I'm one of those people. Like, I own a guitar that I've had for 10 years and can't play more than 5 chords on it,
mm-hmm.
which I'm ashamed of it. Like, it's really sad. I've never had a lesson. And so I'm very, very interested in what they're doing with Rock Band 3 because the idea of it being a bridge between playing music games and playing actual instruments is really not only like fascinating to me, but extremely attractive. And I posted something in the forums this week. I was like, you know, when this comes out, I'm probably just going to get the game only and then buy the MIDI adapter because I already have a keyboard. So I can use my existing keyboard and play the new stuff with that. And I already have all the other instruments. But eventually, in time, I'm seriously considering buying that like Fender Squire controller that has real strings and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would like to own a real electric guitar. I have amps for harmonica. I have a guitar that I can't fucking play. So I would love to own a real electric guitar, but I would also love to have that game controller, and I would love to have the software that could actually help me learn to play the real guitar.
Yeah.
Like, that's very, very compelling for me.
Especially for all the time investment you put into games like Rock Band and Guitar Hero. If you want to get really good at the game, it would be nice to be able to translate that into something.
And also the expense of lessons.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you think about it, if you can buy a game that has standardized lessons that are actually effective, mm-hmm. then that's a really, really good value compared to weekly lessons with a teacher.
Well, yeah. Let's see how well you can actually learn from that thing, though. I mean, that's really what it
comes
down to.
Right, that's the big question.
Now, what's interesting, though, is that they announced this, what, like a week before E3, the whole Fender Squire thing?
Mm-hmm.
And what was funny is another company had a similar product that's not out yet, PowerGig.
Yeah, but were you surprised that happened?
Really? I was a little surprised that, I mean, they obviously were already working on it, but I have to feel like I wasn't nearly as surprised as the guys who were working on PowerGig, or they would not have been making PowerGig.
I felt like every time I heard anything about PowerGig, I thought, I'm glad that somebody's doing this, but it sounds like a kind of a shitty way to do it. And I bet the people who make Rock Band could do a much better job of this. And then, big surprise, they are.
Yeah, I know. It was really funny, though, because I saw it at PAX. I was like, that could be kind of cool. And then I saw their booth E3. I'm like, those poor bastards.
Yeah.
But what's interesting, though, is that there's two I'm super awesome at Rock Band packages going on. Because there's also that completely moronic, what was it, the 40-button guitar?
Yeah, that Mad Cat's guitar is, I haven't touched it, but I've seen it up close, and it's crazy looking. it looks really expensive.
It does. They had it in a glass case at E3 that you couldn't touch. It was in a glass case right by the exit, and I remember walking by and going, holy shit, what the hell were they thinking?
Yeah, it's really weird. I mean, I think the real guitar controller with real strings is much more compelling because it's going to cost marginally more, but then you can actually plug it into an amp and play it like a real guitar.
So what I expected was that if a company made a game to teach you to play guitar, it was going to be something closer to the 130-button monstrosity. Because it's very digital at that point. There was a button for every string on every fret, and that was why there were so many buttons.
Right. You're right. I mean, it's hyper-digital.
Right.
The problem with that is it can teach you the fingerings, but it's not really going to give you the tactile feel of playing
guitar. No, it's not. But I'm not...
Because it doesn't have the tension on the string. And...
But it's much easier for the system to recognize if you're right or not, which
right.
I understand how they're probably doing it. It's probably through harmonic tuning.
No, you're wrong, actually. The way on the Squire controller, the real guitar controller, the way they're doing it is that it has pressure sensors on each fret, and so you push a string in between two frets, and it senses that the fret below and above it are both being pressed down,
yeah.
And so it knows that you're in between them.
Yeah.
I would have actually thought that the Mad Cat's 130-button version would be more precise, but when I saw the guy on stage playing with the Squire, I was like, oh shit, that works.
Yeah.
It was one of those moments where I thought, oh my god, technology is so cool.
That was definitely one of the weirder press events of...
Because you had the guy on stage who, like, curses every five words.
Yeah. He's like, I'm supposed to say this to my boss, but fuck my boss, man. It was the weirdest fucking show.
That guy, and I've seen him give Rock Band demos in previous years, and they're always like that.
My first thought when he started playing it was, okay, so they basically went around Boston and found the best guitarist they could and hired him to do something at their studio so they could say he works for them.
Because what he was playing wasn't even that technically challenging. I mean, compared to what you do in a normal Guitar Hero game, it's a lot more complicated.
Right.
But compared to what a real guitar player does, it was pretty simple stuff. He was playing chords.
There's got to be some kind of mechanism built into that game regarding actual learning chords and stuff beyond music. Because otherwise...
Yes. It better be.
Otherwise, yeah. You're effed because you're not going to know what the hell you're doing.
Right.
It's like teaching a kid to play a stringed instrument, which I've done before, without them knowing how to read music. It's like, well, I can tell you how to play each song, but it doesn't really help you play other songs.
Right, you're just kind of memorizing patterns.
Yeah.
You don't really know what you're doing.
You're giving him a fish instead of teaching him how to fish. Huh?
Well, no, it was me getting paid immediately because his parents are impressed, or me telling him, no, honestly, he's learning. Trust me.
The hustler, James Jones.
Pippin
okay, A's. Chopsticks again.
Yeah, so... I mean, I'm with you, James, that from what we've seen so far, it's pretty clear that the technology seems to work. It seems to do everything you would want it to do, like in terms of the hardware.
It's the software.
The other side of the coin is, does the software actually, is it good enough to actually teach you? And that's what we haven't really seen yet.
So I'm curious how many people are going to buy that thing. And I don't think it's going to sell that well, obviously.
But Rock Band 3 can also teach you how to play drums. With the stock drum thing, especially if you buy like a cheap cymbal kit, hi-hat kit for it,
mm-hmm.
because that's the thing, they've talked the most about pro guitar, but also has pro drums built in, also has pro bass, which uses the same controllers as the guitar, and then also has pro keyboard. And pro keyboard is, you can play it with any keyboard instrument that works with Rock Band 3 will support pro keyboard. So it's not like you need a super expensive version.
It just has to have a MIDI out, basically.
Or you can buy the one that comes with the game.
Right.
If you buy that one, that supports pro also, and that's a pretty cheap keyboard. It's like a $70 keyboard.
Isn't it also like a mini keyboard, though?
Yeah, it's two octaves.
Yeah.
That's the other thing I'm looking forward to. Again, I own a keyboard that I cannot fucking play. So,
I own a zither that I cannot play.
Yeah, I'm really, really, really hopeful that Rock Band 3 can help me out, yo.
Somebody better teach me to play this fucking didgeridoo. Damn it.
Well, that's the primary reason that I care about it. Because if it's just more songs, you know, they put songs out every week on Rock Band. Like, that's not good reason to
remember
release
they
a
had
game.
They had this. What did they say they were up to on the song wall?
There'll be 2,000 by the time Rock Band 3 comes out.
Yes. Wow. I mean, That's absurd.
Yeah.
You know, the other cool thing about Rock Band 3 is that even if you don't care about learning a real instrument, what the promo does is it adds a huge new tier of difficulty and mm-hmm. complexity to playing the instruments, even the instruments that you already have, or the instruments that you will have when you buy it, like the keyboard.
Right.
So if you're already awesome at Rock Band and you're totally bored by playing on Expert or whatever, mm-hmm. and again, I say this is, they're catering to the hardcore market, like the hardcore Rock Band Guitar Hero market. I guarantee the stuff they're adding in Pro Mode is way harder than anything that will be in the new Guitar Hero.
Yeah.
Just because it uses so many more buttons and the patterns are so much broader and more complex. So there's that too. I mean, even if, you know, if that's all you care about is I want to be challenged, you will be challenged by Pro Mode, I guarantee it.
Just as an unrelated but somewhat topical question, this is the first time where we've really seen that the Guitar Hero and Rock Band franchises are going in very much diametrically opposed directions.
Yeah, they're very diverse. And I saw that I got a demo. I actually played the new Guitar Hero, Warriors of Rock.
Yes.
Basically what they've done is they've got these characters who have special powers, but the things that their special powers do are all within the framework that's extremely well established of Guitar Hero. So their special powers, like, do things to your multiplier, they do things to your star power, they do things to hammer on and pull offs, but they're not really adding new mechanics. They're just kind of tweaking a little bit the way the existing mechanics work. So they're not really doing anything new, they're just kind of reshuffling things a little bit. And, you know, I'm sure there'll be some good songs on it, and it's feasible that I might even buy
it. It has a story mode, apparently, if that means anything to anyone.
The story mode, it's not that much different from what you've done before.
No.
They make a big deal out of it, but ultimately, you play a bunch of songs.
Well, the thing is, the like Guitar Hero's forte has always been, it's the hardest. It has the hardest songs out there. So if you really want to be the real hardcore guitar game player, you have to go with Guitar Hero. But now, you know, with Pro Mode and Rock Band, that kind of changes things. I mean,
it does, yeah. I think Warriors of Rock is a flight of fancy. Almost literally. I mean, the game is very fantasy-based.
Yeah, it's ironically enough, is like the, what was the name?
Brutal Legend.
Yeah, it's ironically enough, very Brutal Legend themed.
I thought exactly the same thing.
Well, considering the parties involved, that's really fucking funny.
No, you're right. I mean, the new Guitar Hero totally looks like Brutal Legend. In terms of the art style and the attitude of it.
Yeah.
It is absolutely... Brutal
and even the fact they're bringing in like these metal or these really hardcore rock people to narrate things. And
Gene Simmons is the narrator.
Yes, they basically jobbed Brutal Legend and then kicked it to the curb.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the way that they're going with Guitar Hero is a viable alternative to Rock Band. I don't think it's nearly as interesting. I don't think it's nearly as creative. But if you know Rock Band is going to do what they're going to do better than anybody else could even dream of, then if I'm in charge of Guitar Hero, I have to do something different. And I think the way they're going is the logical conclusion to that process.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like the year Rock Band 2 and Guitar Hero World Tour came out and they were basically the same fucking thing.
It's different within the same framework, whereas Rock Band is kind of stepping outside that framework.
I mean, like, the thing that they said over and over and over in that demo of the new Guitar Hero is that instead of being maxed out at like 5 stars on a song, you can get like up to 60 stars in a song.
Oh my god.
It's like, okay, but that's totally arbitrary because you decide what a star means.
What? Why not 61?
So that doesn't actually mean jack shit.
That pretty much is turning it up to 11.
No, it's turning it up to 60.
That could be the subtitle. We're turning it up to 11. Yeah.
Oh, that's horrible.
Like, what an insult to the crowd. Do you like stars? Yay! Do you want more stars?
We're going to give you 3 times as many stars as you've ever gotten before.
What's that? You wanted 55 more stars? Here are 55. It's like a fucking Super Mario Galaxy game.
Yeah.
It would not have surprised me if they had said, you know what? This game has 5,000 achievement points.
I've been thrilled.
That's basically what it is. And there is a crowd that will be interested in that. I get it. It's extremely arcadey. And again, because Rock Band 3 is going so hard simulation with all this pro mode stuff, Guitar Hero, it has to differentiate itself.
I guess it's just funny because they kind of flirted with it in 3 and then kind of renounced that, and now they're going back to that, and even more so than before. It's as the kind of some of the more gamey kind of elements and bosses.
Right.
And all
this is Guitar Hero 3 on steroids.
Nice.
Absolutely. Actually, on crystal meth,
it's kind of starting to remind me of, you know, other sort of overplayed franchises like James Bond or something, where it's like, oh well, the last one was ridiculous, so this one's really serious. It's, oh, the last one was boring, now it's crazy again.
Right, this one you're gonna hang from a helicopter.
This
for
is
an
how
entire
you get
level,
like, you know,
people.
Like Moonraker, and then like Living Daylights, and then we could Die Another Day. It just oscillates in silliness forever.
Like Die Another Day is. when they melt the ice palace with the orbital laser.
Yeah,
it's
man.
One of the dumbest
it's amazing.
Ever. Don't forget, the villain was a North Korean military man genetically reconfigured to look and sound like a loathsome English toff that's good at fencing.
Okay, Greg, you have the last letter.
Okay, Ray757 writes, I was hoping you guys could once again start another discussion on the successor of the Wii. The only clue I see is that it has to have a wow factor that motion control and 3D without glasses have, and it has to be something that will convince their new audience to buy a new system. What does Nintendo have to do to not only bring third parties, but also indie developers to support them? I would love to see companies like Valve, Konami, and Square Enix put their best efforts on a Nintendo platform. Looking back at the library of the N64, GameCube, and Wii, I wonder if they can ever again have a strong console library like they did with the Super Nintendo. Is it as simple as adding HD graphics?
No, I think online is more important than HD graphics.
It's not as simple as adding HD graphics, but they better fucking add HD.
Oh, I don't need HD, it's fine. I was talking about it for 4 minutes, why HD is important in the lesson.
You know, it's a great question. It's been a while since we talked about the successor to the Wii or the Wii HD in any kind of detail. And I think, you know, after E3, you know, it needs to be discussed because, especially with 3DS, 3DS is, in some ways, it's so iterative, it's so safe compared to what the DS, you know, represented at the time that it was shown. Mm. And at the same time, the 3DS is so, it has this whiz-bang wow factor that it seems hard to get across. I mean, the Wii already did that with the motion controls.
Right.
The Wii already had the wow factor. Does Nintendo have it in them to throw out, like, another crazy wow factor to people? The obvious thing, this might sound really, really weird, but the obvious thing to me is that they would sell a console built into a monitor that would have the same or an upgraded version of the 3D technology that's in 3DS. So in other words, it would be a 3D TV with a game system built in that doesn't need glasses. You know, like, basically just short of holograms, which is the stock, ironic answer to this.
It would be
this.
Exorbitantly expensive to produce those screens at that size. Mm-hmm. And also, it would basically mean you have to lug a fucking screen around with you anytime you want to bring
so
your...
It sounds a bit iPad-ish, yeah. And then, again, cost comes into that, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I'm not saying that I think they would actually do that. But, like, to me, that's the most obvious thing right now. It's the easy way out.
Is, you know, you talk about wow factor, but it's the hook, isn't it? You know, the basic kind of hook of why you need to get this. And that, obviously, is more difficult with the audience that Nintendo's playing with now than it has been in
the past. And Nintendo's had trouble with it in the past. They had trouble with N64, and they had trouble with it with GameCube. I mean, what was the thing that set GameCube apart from its competitors?
Tiny discs.
It's kind of smaller, and it has Luigi.
It was primarily, you know, what they said themselves, you know, the Nintendo difference. It's just, well, you know, we're all about games, and our games are on this system, and you want to play them. And that certainly applied to, you know, a decent number of people, plenty of faithful Nintendo fans and whatnot, but at the end of the day...
But we know that's not good enough for Nintendo.
Not on the sort of scale that the video game industry has reached now, and certainly not on the scale that Nintendo's managed to capture. And as I say, it will be a challenge to get people to upgrade the kinds of people that they've reached out to here. And it isn't obvious how they're going to do it.
They're going to have to surprise us. I mean, it's going to be something that we are very unlikely to guess at this point.
All Wii 2s come with hologram projectors.
Hologram, yeah, that's a joke that goes back at least 10 years. And, you know, I don't think it's realistic in the foreseeable future. But, I mean, the whole joke of holograms is that it represents the kind of, like, flashy, weird thing that you've never seen before. And
that's not true. I have seen the fog smoke hologram thing that they do. It's so bizarre, but to see it, you're like, I couldn't look at this for more than 5 minutes without my head exploding. I need to walk to the next booth or I'll die.
Okay, I don't know what you're talking about. That sounds interesting. But I mean, I don't envy Nintendo right now because the expectations are so high for their next console. Because I think one of the interesting things about Kinect and Move coming out this year is that sort of levels the playing field. I mean, those technologies may be better or worse than what we can do, but motion control as a concept is now a commodity, basically.
Yeah.
No matter what console you buy, it can do motion controls, yo. And so whatever Nintendo follows up the Wii with, it can't just do motion controls. It has to do something else that gets your attention. And obviously, HD graphics are basically a commodity too, because that's already been done.
And so is online. You know, a big online presence with an online store and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and online multiplayer that works and isn't annoying.
Oh,
yeah,
you're asking too much now.
All of those things are kind of, that's the minimum that the Wii successor has to do. It has to do HD. It has to have good online, and it has to have motion controls that are at least marginally better than what the Wii can do. So it has to do all that stuff, and yet we know that if it just does those three things, it's not going to be good enough. Like, it's not going to be good enough for Nintendo, and it's not going to be good enough for consumers to say, oh, I got to buy a new system. So Nintendo has to think of something that nobody has ever done before, and I don't know what it is.
Well, clearly you wouldn't, would you? I mean,
yeah, if we did, we'd ruin it for them.
I wonder, though, I mean, it could be an awkward spot for them in terms of, is there a particular innovation, a new hook that's not quite ready to come to market yet? But at the same time, there's money to be made by putting out some sort of revision, some sort of change that the dedicated Nintendo fans that just want, you know, the better online infrastructure, the HD graphics, those core kind of improvements that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So they could be caught in a sort of tricky period there where there's kind of a clamor for something new, but to give people something that is as innovative as they'd like, perhaps on cost terms, it's not quite there yet. And I do wonder whether we might see a more intermediate step for the first time with Nintendo, a sort of more of like a deluxe Wii, you know, the Wii HD, perhaps than the full-on, complete revolution sort of successor that would come. Not necessarily because they'd want to, ideally, but because they just can't make that leap yet.
Yeah, and because they have to sell new hardware.
Yeah, because, I mean, for them, that is a revenue stream that has to be maintained.
Like, their investors expect them to sell a lot of hardware all the time. Mm-hmm. And make a profit on it.
Yes.
So you're right, Greg. I mean, what could very potentially happen is that Nintendo puts out a new console in the next year or 2 years, that they're not really satisfied with the level of innovation it brings to the marketplace, but they kind of have to put it out there because Wii sales have slowed down. Mm-hmm. And as I've said before, Sony and Microsoft don't want to release a new system because it costs them too much money. Like, they lose too much money.
Yeah,
they
want to
sell the existing system.
They're only just starting to turn it around a little bit.
Right.
Like, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm. And Nintendo knows that they've sold so many systems already. They're getting to diminishing returns on Wii. You know, they're never going to meet their previous sales records on Wii. And even if they do, even if they get close to it, they're selling it at a reduced price, so they're not making the money that they used to make. They're not getting the margins. So at some point, Nintendo feels an internal pressure, as well as an external stockholder pressure, to release a new system, even if they're not really ready to creatively.
Well, and I mean, they'll know the demand is there. They know that there's going to be a lot of Nintendo people out there, you know, that will say, if I get to play, might get maybe it uprates the old games. Maybe, as I think you've spoken to this before, John, but you know, it may well be not the case that Nintendo says, right, well, we're going to make everything sort of up to certain HD standards. But the fact is, there would be certain games that would come out that would take full advantage of HD and superior graphics, and people, you know, it would get lured in with that promise and maybe certain other upgrades. So in some ways, if they did want to wait before releasing a sort of more innovative successor, but they didn't serve that demand, they would be essentially leaving profit on the table, unexploited.
And they don't want to do that because they know their competitors will take advantage of it. I mean, if there's a ripe market and they don't take advantage of it, their competitors will, and their investors know that.
Exactly. So, I mean, that wouldn't really be in keeping with Nintendo's generally pretty effective profit-making abilities to leave that untapped. But, I mean, go back to the original question, the bit about a strong console library on par with the Super NES and all that. I mean, I don't think that's ever going
to
happen.
No, I mean, they would have to basically completely own their market.
Which won't happen. Gaming is too big to dominate in the way that Nintendo dominated
it's
it.
It's too big
past.
And there's a lot more competition now.
Well, it's not just that. It's not in the interest of the publishers to be that beholden to one platform. I mean, they wouldn't let that happen.
Yeah. I do think that whatever the next console from Nintendo is, I think they will continue to stress the inexpensiveness of their development.
Yeah.
Because that's obviously appealing to game developers and publishers. I mean, you look at the library, just the volume of the library on Wii is a testament to that. And, you know, you've still got publishers who don't seem to be putting out much good stuff on Wii, but they still publish games on Wii because the margins are high. Because the games are so cheap to make, they don't have to sell that many copies to make money on it.
In the case of someone like Ubisoft, I mean, they do make a pretty good chunk of their revenue overall out of Wii, even though you might like point to some of the higher profile titles not doing that well.
Right, Red Steel 2.
But otherwise, you know, they are generating some significant revenue out of it. So yeah, I mean, I don't think Nintendo will try and shift their position relative to developers in that way. No, I mean, yeah, the tech may scale up, but the paradigm will still be, you know, this is the no strings attached kind of laissez-faire, low cost development friendly environment.
Well, I mean, my question is like, what kind of game can't Nintendo make with the Wii hardware right now outside of first-person shooters?
That's a logical fallacy. They could make first-person shooters.
No. But I'm just saying though, that's what Nintendo always says. They're like, we'll make new hardware when there is a game out there that we want to make, but we can't make it.
Yeah, but yes. Okay, first off, that's kind of bullshit. That's just something Nintendo says. You know, there's not much Nintendo has put out on Wii that couldn't have been done on GameCube aside from Wii Sports Resort.
But, I mean, typically all they need is one title to do that with, though. That's what I'm saying. Like, Super Mario 64.
We need to make Wii Sports.
Yeah.
They love to build this story that Miyamoto had this idea that was so big and so new that their old system couldn't have done it. We didn't want to sell you a new $300 system, but we had to get this amazing Miyamoto
but
game.
But Nintendo, historically, they will make all new hardware for a single game concept.
GameCube, not so much.
No, I think it's just that they let Miyamoto design controllers, basically. But they release new systems not because they have this one amazing game that they just have to release. It's because they want to make more money. That's why they make new systems.
They're a business.
I think
but
they may, with the stranger dynamics in the market that we have now, where, as you said, I mean, you know, we're kind of looking at a more drawn-out console cycle in a lot of ways and all this, I think they might be stretching that pretense to breaking point this
time.
Yeah,
I mean,
before.
What game for DSi did they just have to release a new hardware iteration?
And obviously
Photoshop.
There's a lot more history of them doing that sort of crap in the portable space, you know, the Pocket and Color and Advance. And SP and Micro and
look,
so
they
forth.
They couldn't make Link's Awakening without Color. Oh, wait.
They did. But so, I mean, that obviously has been associated with the portables, but I think it really depends on whatever their big idea is for the next year. If they've got a big idea that they can realize.
You're saying a big technology idea, not a big game idea.
If they've got a big technology idea that they can realize in the near term, then maybe the intermediate the stopgap revenue generator hardware will not be necessary. But if it is necessary to sort of keep them bobbing along until they can bring something a bit more radical to the market, then it's really, it is going to be tough for them to just, this is going to be like, well, actually, we couldn't do Pikmin without it looking this detailed.
Yeah. They're gonna make up some story like that, but
I do think though that they come up with ideas for their next hardware, and then they pick them based on the games they can build. So that's probably the closest thing the narrative is, where they say like, we have ideas for this hardware versus this hardware. Let's go with this guy, because I don't think the 3DS was the only concept they had when they went forward. Of course, that doesn't explain what the fuck happened with the DS, because I refuse to believe they had any ideas that said this hardware is perfect for this game.
Yeah, again, that whole story is a fallacy that they have this one game that they have to release a new console for. But let me just say, I think the Wii was a sea change in the market, and it is extremely hard to do that twice in a row.
A blue ocean?
No, it's kind of as we were talking about last week. It just, that's generally not what happens. You know, when you get these big shifts in the market dynamics, it tends to be the next one along is more of a continuation of that before there's another kind of disruption. And
which is honestly probably what we'll see from the next consoles, that it will be, you know, a minor iteration. I mean, Nintendo will talk a big game about, here's this crazy new feature, but
it's the power
most
glove.
Likely it's not going to have the impact that motion controls did. But the thing is, Nintendo cannot afford to have a 10-year console cycle like Sony says that they want.
Well, it's just not the most profitable thing to do.
Yeah, they're not going to say, you know what, we don't have an idea that's as good as motion controls, so we're just going to let this system marinate for another 5 years.
We're going to let it ride.
That is not going to happen.
The reality is there are Nintendo fans out there right now that would quite happily part with something like $300 of their money to buy some sort of enhanced version of the Wii with the promise that it would have better software in terms of taking advantage of better tech.
Sure, they're called me.
And, you know, to their advantage, there are a lot more Nintendo fans now than there were 5 years ago.
Exactly.
A lot more. A lot of people who would at least consider buying a new Nintendo system. So, we gotta wrap this up, but I want to make a final comment on the idea that Valve and Square Enix and Konami would put their top, like, their best games on a Nintendo console. The way to do that is to make the system really inexpensive to develop for and really attractive to high-tier developers. In other words, developers who want the best technology and the largest marketplace, which right now they have one of those with Wii.
Take your pick.
Yeah. Right now, the way the market is, you can either have the best technology or you can have the largest user base, but you can have both together. So if Nintendo can put together a system that combines those, and keep development costs down below what you have for other systems, then it is feasible that you could have these really elusive, high-quality third-party companies develop their best games for a Nintendo console. But that is very hard to put on a box.
Well, there's obvious tensions there in terms of having the best tech and selling to the most people, because products that retail for a lesser price tend to sell to more people. And
but what I'm saying is you can't put a blurb on the box of your system that says cheapest development kits.
Well, you could, but it wouldn't be a very strong marketing pitch.
That doesn't mean anything to the market. So unless that translates into the best games, then people don't care.
And when we talk about putting their best efforts forward, I mean, that is subjective in some ways as well. I mean, you know, would we say that Square, you know, haven't put their best foot forward on DS because, you know, they're making Final Fantasy 13. A lot of people would quantify the developer's best efforts by proxy, their most expensive efforts. You know, they're putting the most effort into that. You know, whereas, is that necessarily the best? Or perhaps it's just extravagant, indulgent, and wasteful. You know, maybe in terms of design, they are putting their best efforts into a lower cost. I mean, that's very difficult to kind of verify.
Well, you've certainly got companies like Valve and Infinity Ward or Respawn, if you want to look at it that way.
Yeah.
And Bethesda. You've got all these very, very large game developers who make really big, famous games that are not on the Wii.
They're not even on it. Yeah, exactly. I mean,
they are not even released on the Wii. And I think that there is a potential for Nintendo to look at the next generation, at the next version of their console as, let's make a system that every developer will consider making games for, because I guarantee you Valve never spent more than 3 days considering whether to put a game on the Wii.
No, they looked at it and said, no, we can't.
There's a value to that.
The key problem with that is Nintendo will always craft hardware for two things. First of all, that they can sell for a profit at some sort of mass market price. And second of all, that comports with what they prioritize in game development. And what they prioritize in game development is at times very radically different to what some other, you know, esteemed, excellent, admirable development houses prioritize. And therefore, there will be built into the hardware itself, quite literally, a sort of incompatibility.
I mean, I agree with you, but I think, unfortunately, Nintendo's vision of the software that they want to bring to a new system tends to be very short-sighted. If you look at the Wii, they did Wii Sports, and then 3 years later, they did Wii Sports Resort. But I mean, what was their vision for how they designed Wii? What was their vision for bringing games to Wii? They didn't, I mean, they did a couple of really experimental things up front, and then they kind of went back to making the games that they had made on GameCube.
That's part of Nintendo's sort of more economic approach to things, though. They always said that there is greater specificity and there's shorter time horizons. There's none of this PS3 10-year shite. They are looking at what will make money now,
right,
or in the near term. And that's why you have so many peripherals that are very specific to single games, because they made the decision to make that peripheral on the basis that it would make the money for one game, not that it would have to be applied to several pieces of software to be profitable in the long run. They're a ruthless, bottom-line-driven company.
Right, that's why there's... That's why there aren't many games that support Wii Speak, because they basically made it for Animal Crossing.
Well, and it doesn't work.
And they don't really give a shit if any other games use it.
Yeah, that's by the by. So with that kind of approach is very opposed to the way other platform holders or, you know, software developers are. And that's why I think there's always going to be this tension, because Nintendo will craft an environment in its own image, and the image of other developers is just very different.
Well, you know, I mean, this isn't really directly related, but the Blaster, whatever the hell they called it.
Zapper?
The Zapper Shell, yeah. I remember the boot up for Sin and Punishment tells you how to hold the Zapper, and my first thought when I saw that was, fuck you, I am not playing that game with the Zapper. It is impossible.
How much overlap could there possibly be between people who own a Zapper and people who go by Sin and Punishment Star Successor?
I mean, I own Lynx Crossbow Training, and I don't have both.
The fact they said, you know, let's try to shoehorn the Zapper in here. It's like, fuck you.
It's cute. It's I like
it. It's like it makes you feel like Elliot Ness.
Yeah, good. That's a nice reference.
Okay, well, that was a great question, Ray757. Thank you very much. We do have one last email here.
Quite possibly the best email we've ever received.
I don't believe it is.
So it's a classic one.
Sam wants to know, why doesn't Metroid ever take off his armor? James, what do you think about that?
I think Sam has a very good question. I think we all should wonder why Metroid doesn't ever take off his armor.
I think it's because he would get cold.
I think he's just shy.
This is. I saw this email and I laughed for a good 3 minutes.
I think it's beautifully tuned to just be nonsensical. I love it. I don't think we've ever got anything quite this sublime. I mean, the farthest I could go back was when there was the blowback on the Phantom Hourglass review that Zach did. This is back when Carl was doing the show.
To be fair, Zach's review is a bitch. there was some
guy that like sent in 7 pieces of hate mail ostensibly from different addresses, but he's clearly the same person.
Right,
and at some point, he called the staff of our website rectum raiders. So, I mean, this isn't hateful like that, so that's good.
But it's still brilliantly
nonsensical.
I responded amongst us to this email when we got it, because I just happened to have my email open when it came in, and I responded just as a reflex because it was so damn funny. And then I thought, oh god, I'm going to spend half the episode saying it wasn't me.
Why doesn't Metroid ever take off his armor?
should we forward it to our NOA contact and ask? I mean,
yeah, we need an official Nintendo statement.
We do not give statements regarding Metroid and his armor.
Perhaps there'll be a long monologue in Other M where she'll tell us that she's in fact not a woman and never takes off her armor.
Yes, stay tuned for Metroid Other M when you'll find out. Metroid doesn't take off his armor because he doesn't want you to see the Other M. Okay.
Genius. By the way, Sam, please write us again because holy shit.
Yeah, thank you so much to everybody who wrote in this week. We got some wonderful emails this week, including several from people who'd never written in before and have been listening for a long time, and I love seeing that. Thank you so much. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. If you've never had the pleasure of hearing your email read on the air and having a insightful and or absurd conversation come out of it, I highly encourage you to give it a shot, and you will be contributing to making this show funnier and better. Thank you very much. It's rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. So that's going to do it for this episode. Thank you so much to everybody for listening, and thanks to James, Greg, and John for joining me this week and every week on Radio 3 Nintendo.
Later.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I mean, FF13, I've heard that the Xbox version is really an Xbox port, but I've heard it's fine.
It's okay for a Philistine like James.
I'm sorry, I decided not to go buy into a console that is all about the hubris, just like John Lindemann.
Oh, come on. See, that's the thing, James. That'll be your ultimate downfall.
You
put your hatred of Sony before your love of games.
That console is literally the John Lindemann of consoles.
Wow. It is very shiny on
Incredibly
top.
Good looking. Very powerful.
No, it didn't say that. It's actually kind of a hideous looking system.
I know.
Virile.
Writes his name with Spider-Man fonts. Yes, exactly.
It's $599.
Expensive too, eh?
That's a little bit high for John.
Yeah.
And finally, for those of you that wanted some sort of awful reprise of episode 103, there's this.
I think the name of Judge Judy's autobiography is Don't Pee on Me and Tell Me It's Raining.
That's awesome.
Judge Judy's a sexy lady.
I love Judge Judy, man.
Booming granny, because
Mrs.
I need
Shineland,
you.
Pull up your robe.
Don't pee on my leg and tell me it's raining.
Actually, please, pee on my leg.
Oh, Jesus, no. You got that, right, John?
I want that's ya, booming granny.
Golden showers fill your eyes.
Oh, dear.
I want ya.
Oh, that stings.
That's what I was worried about, why John always talks about B. Arthur now.
Golden Girls.
B. Arthur, Judge Judy. At the same time, go.